This is KBOO Radio. Coming up next is More Talk Radio with Celeste Carey. The topic is Afghanistan with Reuben Bigerty of the Center for American Progress and Carl Conetta, co-director at the Project on Defense Alternatives.
Good morning, good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. 90.7 here in the greater Portland metropolitan area. In the Willamette River, it's 100.7. Get my numbers straight. In Gorge, it is 91.9. And on the web, so you can tell your friends far flung and wide, they can point and click at www.kboo.fm. More talk radio this morning on Monday, March 16, 2009. I'm Celeste here on More Talk Radio, your solo host today, Celeste Carey. And I have with me two guests. But before I announce them, I'll let you know a little bit about them and the topic today. We're going to discuss Afghanistan and Pakistan, what our U.S. policy may be toward them, what our idea of success may look like, what we may have to concede to have the success that we really need worldwide, and our guests will help us discuss these points. Some of you may have been down in Salem for the rally yesterday because you didn't want to see the National Guard troops sent out. And so you might be thinking, here we go again, what kind of changes have there been made? What do we have to look forward to? And Afghanistan has an interesting history. It's been called the graveyard of empires. And granted, that was minimally a reference to wars in the last two centuries, just most recently and with Russia and earlier in Britain. However, history will repeat itself, and maybe it's because we don't seem to learn our lessons the first time. Given Obama's deployment of more U.S. troops, complaints that other countries are not sending enough troops, unclear strategies for why we are sending more troops, one wonders what new lessons in store here for the U.S. So today we are joined by Ruben Brigerti and Carl Canetta to discuss the U.S. response to the current environments in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And Ruben Brigerti is a PhD. He is also the director of the Sustainable Security Program at the Center for American Progress, whose work focuses on the role of development assistance in U.S. foreign policy. Other areas of expertise are U.S. national security, human rights, and humanitarian affairs. Prior to joining American Progress, he served as special assistant and the Bureau for Democracy, Conflict, and Humanitarian Assistance in the U.S. Agency for International Development. Carl Canetta is co-director, Project on Defense Alternatives, and his expertise is U.S. defense policy and planning, military transformation, and readiness issues, military defense, defense alternatives, arms control, and much concern with strategic planning within the military. So they are both joining us, and you can also join us by dialing 503-231-8187, and we'll expand on what our topics would be and what kind of questions you might want to ask our guests. Good morning. I have both Ruben and Carl. Do you prefer to be called that?
Yeah, that's fine. Good morning.
Okay.
Pleasure to be with you.
Good morning. Good morning. Thank you for taking time out of your day to come and talk with us here today. And there are so many different ways we could approach this. And one of the things that, if we have time, just because it has a local touch, is if either of you feel comfortable discussing the whole federalization of the National Guard, we might talk a little bit about that. But initially, I want to talk a little bit just about what our current policy is, a thumbnail sketch, if you could, of our current policy is both for Afghanistan and for Pakistan. Not so much what it should be yet, just what it is now.
Celeste, this is Ruben.
Thank you, Ruben.
First of all, we have been engaged in both combat operations and various forms of nation building in Afghanistan for over 7 years now. As we all know, the original purpose for U.S. intervention, and indeed Western intervention in Afghanistan post-2001, was the September 11th attacks, and the notion that those attacks came from al-Qaeda, which was based in Afghanistan, and had fled across the Durand Line into Pakistan. There is a strong stream of thought that U.S. interests or U.S. prosecution of the war in Afghanistan was distracted by virtue of our engagement in Iraq for a variety of reasons. But one of the things that President Obama has said for years, certainly even prior to becoming a presidential candidate, was that the war in Iraq was a misguided mistake, but the war in Afghanistan, in his view at the time, was one that is essential to prosecute. It is a fair debate now about what exactly U.S. priorities should be in regard to Afghanistan going forward, but there are a couple of things that are clear from the current situation. The first is that there is still an al-Qaeda threat in Afghanistan, Pakistan, probably more so in Pakistan than Afghanistan. Secondly is that the government in Afghanistan is still relatively weak. It is not able to extend its remit over the entire country. It cannot provide services for all its citizens and therefore cannot sustain a fight against an insurgency by itself. It is also clear that whatever happens in Pakistan is an extremely linked to what's happening in Pakistan as well. We know that elements of the Pakistan Intelligence Services, the ISI, helped create the Taliban some 15, 20 years ago. We also know that much of the instability that is happening in Pakistan politically allows the level of ungoverned spaces in the Northwest Frontier Province and the Fatah to continue unabated, which is net, and there's a fair amount of evidence that that's where al-Qaeda still remains. So it's clear that the president has decided, by virtue of it adding more troops, that he is going to be committed to Afghanistan, although we do not yet know exactly what our strategy is going to be going forward. But it is clear that he still sees a major threat to U.S. interests in Afghanistan, and that's why I suspect he intends to remain engaged there for the foreseeable future.
Now, this question is also for both of you. Given the fact that he has committed the troops to helping stabilize the environment and especially for the government to help protect the people and be concerned about either making sure that there's an infrastructure for elections or just a physical infrastructure, that I understand that. But beyond that, we don't really have much of a plan going into it, and that's been a source of a lot of complaints, minimally, just complaints and criticism. Any thoughts on why we moved without having at least some strategy of to how we wanted to deploy the troops?
This is Carl. I don't think it's quite right to say that we have no plan. It's not very well articulated, but there are some general ideas. One, and everyone pays heed to this, is the idea that there's no military solution, that whatever military investment we make is supposed to serve some broader objective that is non-military. Unfortunately, I think what we see is that the principal investment that is being made is military. That's the instrument we have at hand. Our immediate objectives there, the immediate plan, is to try to, quote, secure the population, unquote. And what that means is trying to, in key areas, have a greater U.S. presence that would partner, first discover local allies, partner with them to secure those areas against Taliban influence, and combine that with increased resort to strikes against sanctuaries, mostly in Pakistan. And that's supposed to be the foundation by which we secure the areas, and then development activities can hopefully begin to take hold. Though most of the initiative on the development side now, the new initiative, seems to me to be tied directly to military objectives. So what we'll see is sort of as part of trying to find allies, that those who work with us will see some sort of financial benefit, and we can think about the strategy used in the Sunni areas in Iraq where essentially we purchased allies, and to see if that can be transplanted in the Afghan environment.
Would that be advisable? Would that be advisable to try to purchase allies? Because I understand that one of our biggest issues is that the United States needs to accept the fact that should we have the elections maybe today, we may have more of a religious-based government, that there will be different allies than maybe we have initially wanted to come forward. And is the United States willing to accept the fact that we won't necessarily have secular government arising out of the current environment?
In Afghanistan, I think that now is taken for granted, that we're playing with the players that are in play, and that the secular forces there are not that powerful, at least in rural areas. It's a very conservative, fundamentalist country in the rural areas. And that's who we have to relate to. Essentially, they are tribal forces, and a real question can be raised about whether this is just an extension of the strategy that produced the power, or let's say continued the power of warlords in Afghanistan. So the end game is unclear. Do we actually lead to a more stable government by building up tribal power in the southern Pashtun areas? Yes, we can probably, in my opinion, we can probably reduce the level of insurgency after we go through a period of increased violence, but do we ever stabilize the nation? And I think this question applies to Iraq, too. It seems to me that in both places, we really haven't discovered a way to get to that desired endpoint. The country is stable, and we are able to leave.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. This is More Talk Radio. I'm Celeste Carey. We're speaking today with Carl Canetta and Ruben Burgetti, and we do have line open if you'd like to call at 503-231-8187, and we have a caller waiting online. Good morning, LJ.
Hey,
thanks
good
for calling.
Morning, Celeste. Good morning, Carl.
Morning.
I have a couple of questions. Apparently, Mr. Karzai is an extremely corrupt man, and I understand that Mr. Karzai's brother is involved in the opium drug trade, and as it stands right now, it's my understanding that that Afghanistan now produces 91% of the world's heroin. And I'm just wondering if the economy of Afghanistan will be based on the opium trade, because I really do understand that in Afghanistan, they grow these incredibly world-class apricots along other fruits, and I can't seem to find any Afghanistani products in my American supermarkets, and I'm just wondering what the government plans to do about that, and I certainly will take my answer off the air. Thank you very much. Have a lovely day.
Well, thank you, LJ. And, yeah, thank you, especially given the fact that he's got such a high unemployment rate and a high poverty line as well.
Is that a question for Carl or for me?
Well, either one. I think he addressed it initially to Carl, but I'd still like to hear what you have to say, too, Ruben, afterwards.
Why don't you start in from the development perspective, and I can
sure. Well, the question is, well, it's a multifaceted question. I mean, starting from one point of it, I mean, is Afghanistan going to have a narco-economy? And the fact of it is that it does, essentially. I mean, a little less than half of the economy comes from drugs, and a little less than half comes from foreign aid. That tiny little sliver in the middle comes from the export of things like animal pelts and ground nuts and things. That has to change. Now, part of the reason that exists, there are a number of reasons why that continues to exist. One is that obviously the insurgents and various warlords have an interest in maintaining the drug trade and skimming the profits off both for themselves and also to fuel the insurgency. But there are also, frankly, some very practical developmental reasons why it exists. I mean, opium actually is a very stable crop. It's one that you can grow, that doesn't require an awful lot of water. It's one that can be warehouse for a long period of time, unlike other crops which require a much greater irrigation infrastructure and a much greater infrastructure to make sure the markets get from the field to market. Now, those are the sorts of things like both being able to improve market access, being able to improve market infrastructure, being able to provide credit to farmers so they can plan for next year's crop. Those are the sorts of developmental instruments which can be brought to bear on this problem and help develop Afghanistan's agricultural economy and move it away from things like opium development. But as some have suggested, we can essentially have a choice. We can either sort of fight the insurgency or we can fight the drug war, but we may not be able to do both simultaneously. I'm not sure that I accept that proposition, but it certainly is one that has been advocated elsewhere. And how when there are multiple ways to deal with the drug trade. One can sort of go for a means of eradication. One could say that we will simply buy the crop so that we farmers get paid, but the money doesn't go directly to drug lords. You could argue that we will allow farmers to grow it, but instead of having a strategy against eradication, we will instead have a strategy of interdiction, where we actually sort of target the transshipment points of opium out of Afghanistan. But let me just say one last thing with regard to the question of corruption. And President Karzai's brother being involved or having links to the drug trade. You know, this is a major issue with regard to our European allies. In many aspects of Europe, Afghanistan has become to be seen as an American war as opposed to a NATO/US-European war. And part of the reason for that is the level of corruption that European publics are aware of that exists in this government. And there simply is not the political will inside Europe, at least not as of a few months ago, to do heavy lifting in Afghanistan as much as we would like them to. So that is going to be a real operational problem for us as the president unrolls his strategy for Afghanistan and as we try to figure out our way forward there.
And for most of us who are sitting on the sides watching it, we see that manifested as reluctance to send troops minimally, right?
I think there is absolutely no question that we are not going to get any substantial numbers of troops out of the Europeans for Afghanistan. The real question is whether or not we'll be able to get other sorts of assistance in the forms of either money for foreign assistance to help agricultural development or other sorts of civilian technical experts to go to the ground mm-hmm. there. And frankly, I suspect that the president will make that pitch when he goes to Europe for a NATO anniversary and for an EU meeting in early April. But whether or not the Europeans will be able to deliver remains to be seen.
Is the fact that there's concern about the level of corruption the only difference in the vision of what would be considered a stable Afghani government that kind of separates the U.S. from the rest of the world? Is that the only sticking point?
I think there are a variety of sticking points. I mean, one is a much more kind of world-weary sort of realist approach that some find in some aspects, say, of sort of the British foreign policy elite, which is that if we are lucky, if we were able to have a massive growth rate and turn and did a full court press in Afghanistan, 10 or 20 years from now, we'd be lucky if we got Afghanistan to look like Bangladesh. But it's certainly never going to look like Switzerland. It's really not in our lifetimes or our children's lifetime. And then there are others who would say that, look, if to the extent that we're going to remain in Afghanistan, it's not simply enough to go for minimalist objectives like ensuring it doesn't become a safe haven on terrorists. There are serious human rights issues in Afghanistan, particularly with regard to girls and women, so long as
yes.
Western money goes towards those governments. We have an obligation to ensure that those human rights obligations are met. Now, which of these visions are enacted or which portions of them are and how one balances these sorts of trade-offs it's the million-dollar question, obviously. And I think that as the president unrolls his new strategy, he will inevitably have to have these conversations with our allies. And I think the extent to which they have a say in helping determine which way we go will depend in large measure on what, frankly, they're prepared to bring to the table.
You know, one of the long-standing issues that divide us from our European allies and many of our allies in the world is the extent to which we emphasize and they de-emphasize military action in general. It's a basic philosophical difference at this point, which I think is grounded in the experiences of countries that over the past 200 years, Europe has experienced 30 times as many warfare deaths as has the United States. They have a different view, a different initial take on war and what it can accomplish. So presently, the numbers of troops that, that Europe has deployed to Afghanistan is not that much less than what we have there. It's approximately equal. Now, with the escalation that is currently underway, we will probably end up carrying two-thirds of the burden. But the troops that they do have there do not emphasize offensive action against the Taliban. They are emphasizing their approach, which tends to put development activities first and security activities second. So there's a real reluctance to engage the Taliban and others. Now, this is changing somewhat over the past year, and it's not to say that they don't engage in combat, but they certainly have a different approach and a reluctance to sort of go after the Taliban and try to suppress that insurgency in a direct way. That's a basic philosophical difference. And in a way, it kind of goes to the heart of the problem I was talking about earlier, which is that we all pay homage to the idea that the principal solution here has got to be a political one. But then when push comes to shove and we see where the dollars go, a relatively small amount of the money being expended in Afghanistan goes to, I think it's about 7% of the total, to development activities. So there's a problem there in taking our words and transforming them into deeds. And that same problem is kind of reflected in the division between us and Europe. And one of the results is that the activities in Afghanistan, with all of the countries that are involved, the activities don't tend toward being coherent. Different people are pulling in different directions, and the level of cooperation is insufficient.
Thank you very much. You're listening to More Talk Radio here on KBOO Portland, and we do have another caller standing by. If you would like to join in the conversation, 503-231-8187, and you'll have an opportunity to speak with our guests, Carl Canetta and Ruben Brighetti. Good morning.
Good morning. My question is, regardless of U.S. motives for being in Afghanistan, Pakistan, both public and private motivations, do many Afghanis, do they not see the U.S. presence in all its forms in much the same way that they experienced the Soviet incursion during the 80s, the only difference being that we have maybe better weapons right now?
You know, that's a great question. I was in Afghanistan in 2002, immediately after sort of the first shooting phase of Operation Enduring Freedom. And I was working with a human rights NGO at the time. And to my surprise, you know, the Afghans were I wasn't surprised the Afghans welcomed American involvement. What surprised me was I spent a lot of my time in the homes of Afghans who had been killed or had relatives killed or injured as a direct result of American action. So, you know, 500-pound bombs falling on their houses or whatever. And while they mourned their loss of their loved one, they were still very grateful for American intervention. And they saw the engagement of the Americans very differently from the Soviets. Now, that was 7 years ago. And much of the evidence, anecdotal evidence, and even systematic polling evidence we are getting from Afghanistan now suggests that those feelings are changing. But they're not changing for the reasons that the Afghans are seeing us like the Soviets. The Soviets were just rapacious, completely rapacious occupiers, and the Afghans knew it and hated them. Instead, I would argue that it's a result of two things. One is this persistent accidental attacks on civilians or attacks on legitimate military targets that inadvertently kill civilians. And the other thing, frankly, is a lack of expectations. You know there was the Bonn conference in late 2001, the standing up of the Karzai government. All these sorts of things were meant to substantially improve the lives of Afghans. Not only is that not happening in large scale, but to the extent, and Carl's right, our development effort is a relatively small portion of our overall effort in the country. And much of that development effort, frankly, is happening in the South and in the East, where much of the fighting is. It is not happening in the center, the North, or the West, where most of the government's relative allies are in the areas of relative stability. So you have these portions of the country asking, you know, who do I have to kill in order to get some development assistance over here? So I do think that we are definitely on a bubble, if we haven't passed it already, with regard to Afghan acquiescence of U.S. and Western involvement, but it's not for the same reasons of comparing us to the Soviets of a generation earlier.
I tend to agree. I think that, I mean, the Soviet presence there was utterly brutal. The numbers of civilians being killed today really don't rise in comparison to what happened during that period. When we first came in there, it was not simply a question of people being tired of the Taliban. It was a question of people being tired of 20 years of civil war that had devastated the country, and suddenly seeing this energetic response from the United States and its allies to the situation in Afghanistan raised hopes substantially, and they haven't been fulfilled. So what we do see now is 17% of the people, most recent polling data, about 17% supporting attacks on coalition troops. That is actually not bad relative to what we saw in Iraq, where it was much higher. It fluctuated around 50% and much higher in Sunni areas and even rather high in the Shia areas. In Afghanistan, the sentiment against the coalition is stronger in some areas. So that 17% is concentrated in the south and in the east. So it's higher there, and that's not a good level of support for attacks, but it's not quite comparable. What's unfortunate is that if what we see in the next period is an increase in the level of military activity leading to more civilian casualties, we're likely to see those numbers go up. And also, we need to keep in mind that what the Soviets did was not simply more brutal. They also tried, their emphasis was extending the writ of the central government into areas that were not used to having strong central governance. To the extent that we try to replicate that approach, which we haven't so far, at least not very effectively.
Well, that's what I was going to say, not effectively.
Right. And then we begin to run into problems. People want a non-corrupt government that provides them services, but they don't want a lot of government interference in local affairs, and it's difficult to see how the two things are separated. That is a long, long-term process. It can be done, but it can't be done in years. We need to be thinking in terms of decades, and one question we have to ask ourselves is, do we want to be thinking in terms of decades?
Yeah, the thing that just bothers me, really sickens me, is these drone attacks that we have. Taliban enclaves or not, who knows, but all of these people being killed, and it's almost on a weekly, if not almost a daily basis now, under the current administration. And I am just so afraid that Obama and his people are going to be associated with these deaths on a regular basis, that whatever else they're trying to do is going to be subsumed by this, and it is just a very, very troubling and disturbing trend that's going on.
Well, actually, this is a great segue to kind of shift the focus from Afghanistan over to Pakistan. Given the fact that we, to go back to one of my earlier statements, we in the United States need to accept the fact that this is not going to be a Western-style democracy, given the fact that we're having a lot of instability in Pakistan, and that there are a lot more of the insurgents either hiding there, training there, or at some rate exerting their influence there. What is our perspective? What should we doing with with regard to trying to bring Taliban members to the table to talk. There is some thought that maybe we should have more of the more moderate members of the Taliban at the table and sit down and have conversations. Is that possible in your minds?
Well, you know, this is how I think about it. It's important to take what is often called a 3D perspective to all of our security challenges, but particularly with regard to Afghanistan and Pakistan, the 3Ds being development, diplomacy, and defense. We've talked about the defense component, the military component, a great deal. We've also talked to some extent about the development component. We've not talked much about the diplomacy component. And diplomacy has sort of two tracks, as it were. I mean, two ways of thinking about it. There is obviously the conventional great power state-to-state diplomacy that we will have to continue to engage in with regard to U.S. engagement with the Pakistani government, helping them to extend democratic governance and helping them to do sort of very helpful things like President Zardari just did apparently this morning in terms of reinstating Chief Justice in Pakistan. But we also need to be talking with elements of society that are not necessarily in government but are nevertheless major players in security. And in my mind, that means that we have to be willing to figure out if there are any viable interlocutors amongst the Taliban. Taliban are a very broad movement. Some of them are fighting for deep ideological purposes. Other than are engaged in ancient tribal and clan-like disagreements.
Well, you also have to address the fact that there's a growing rift between the Taliban and Al-Qaeda themselves.
Exactly. And we would be foolish not to try to understand those dynamics in great detail and not to try to exploit them for our interests. One thing I will say is that this is an engagement that is likely to be fluid. This is a part of the country where there's a great tradition of there being shifting and fluid alliances. And so it's not like we're going to be able to go sit somewhere, sign a peace deal on an oak table and be done. I mean, this may very well have to be an ongoing exercise, what I like to call sort of tactical diplomacy down to the really sort of grassroots level. But it is an instrument of American influence that we simply cannot leave on the table, and it's going to have to be an integral part of our solution there.
I know that Secretary of State Clinton is scheduling meetings, and her thought is to bring in Iran to participate and maybe be, as you said, the interlocutor. But we do have a caller online. I'd like to get back to my thoughts there, but get the caller quickly. Good morning, Beth. Thanks for calling.
Okay, I'll try to make it quickly. Well, first off, I think we should be minding our own business. I think that they mentioned for security reasons we're doing all this. I think our economics right now here in the States are something that affect our security a whole lot more. When we went into when we attacked Afghanistan after Saudi Arabia hit the towers, I was shocked. I couldn't believe it. First off, the Taliban at that time, the tribal lords were tribal religious lords, not warlords. They had the production of opium way down because it was not something that they wanted in their country. It was way down. We had gone in there previous to the terrorism period that we are going through now and attacking everyone about because of communism. We were, you know, fighting communism. So we went in there and we fought over the heads, and we killed so many people in Afghanistan, along with, of course, the Russia and had been in there and had been killing people. This poor country has just had the, you know what, bombed out of it. And I don't know what we're doing continuing to be there. There is absolutely no reason. We've made it so much worse. We've made the religious tribal lords warlords. Now they're horrible people. They they work for us. They've been working for us since we switched over to Iraq. Bush wanted to go a little bit farther because there wasn't, you know, oil. There was more oil in Iraq, so he went to Iraq. I question everything your two guests say about being there in the first place. And I totally am. I must be European, even though I'm a United States citizen, because I believe, like the two guests said, the Europeans are not that much interested, you know, in that war.
In pursuing the Taliban.
They're not stupid.
Okay. Well, thank you for your call.
You're welcome.
Okay. Carl or Ruben, your thoughts on this? Because there are a lot of United States citizens who feel that, especially given our economy now, that they don't see the purpose in it. Now, I'm sure part of it is going to be the fact that Pakistan has nuclear weapons, but beyond that?
Well, you know, I think, and here we're talking about Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's right that the approach since 2001, on balance, has increased the level of instability. I think that's evident in the surge of Taliban activity on both sides of the border, and the growth in anti-American sentiments. That it is more troublesome today than it was in, say, 2003. And I think that we do need to chart an entirely different course, which narrows military objectives as best as possible to the al-Qaeda core, and tries to fold as much of the Taliban into the governing process inside of Afghanistan as we possibly can. I think that there is, and people talk about using carrots and sticks to invite them in, but at the same time to pressure them militarily. I'm not so sure that we have the balance of that right, and our tendency is to be much more effective with the stick than we are with the carrot. We have talked about talking with the Taliban, and we see the same situation in a way in sort of increased diplomatic approaches to Iran. There is a question about the nature of our diplomacy. My general take is that there is no such thing as the moderate Taliban. There are some people at the lower levels who are opportunistic in the sense that we might be able to pull them in to our program on the basis of economic incentives because they are not as strongly ideologically or politically motivated as some people at the top. But if we're really talking about stabilizing the situation in Afghanistan in the near future, we need to be talking about pulling people at the top in. That is a diplomacy which really is more of a give-and-take diplomacy and not so much the idea of buying people off. If there is a political solution for Afghanistan, it will involve the Taliban in some fashion. And I don't just mean the lower ranks. The long-term progress of that country towards a more liberal or democratic stance, this is something we shouldn't give up on, but it's something that is not going to be principally achieved by military means, and it's not going to be achieved in 2 or 3 years.
How will deploying these extra troops actually aid and abet that perspective?
I'm not sure that it does.
Okay.
I'm not sure that it does.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 here. This is More Talk Radio. We're talking about Pakistan, Afghanistan. If you'd like to join in the conversation, 503-231-8187, and speak with our guests, Ruben Brigetti and Carl Canetta. And we do have one caller online. Good morning.
Good morning, Celeste.
Yes.
Thanks for taking my call. Hi, Carl, Ruben.
Hi.
The thing I needed to point out, and I hope I know you both are knowledgeable enough for this. Speaking of economic incentives, I'm going to try to get around to this question. The lines, the borders in that part of our world were drawn originally by colonial interests, and they did not recognize some of the regional areas, the regions. And my understanding is that major petrochemical interests have plans for a pipeline from the Caspian through Uzbekistan, through Afghanistan, and then through Pakistan, and then China is involved, and once India involved, so they call it the TA, or Turkmenistan, TAPI pipeline. And that pipeline goes to a place called Baluchistan, a 5,000-year-old civilization, arguably partly Bedouin, but places like Quetta are its center. in the south of Pakistan. Thus, it became an independent, a kind of a self-governing state within Pakistan, which I understand might well be falling apart. But that the Baluchistan also involves southern Afghanistan and eastern, southeastern Iran. Now, if the State Department, tell me if I'm wrong, if our State Department and somebody from USAID as well worked with the regional group, couldn't we also then include Iran in a comprehensive peace? Now, the question is, can we get the Baluchi people, to go along with this pipeline idea as an economic incentive? Can those moderates you speak of in the Taliban say, oh, well, this could be money? I threw out a whole bunch there, but I hope you can make sense of it, and I'll shut up and listen on the air. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your question.
I can't speak intelligently about the specifics of the pipeline, but let me sort of try to address a couple of points that you raised. You are correct in that the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan is one that is almost completely arbitrary. Clearly, the local tribes there on the ground, the Baluchistan and Waziristan and others, basically don't recognize the border. And it's a very difficult border to defend, and goods and other things flow across it with virtual impunity. But to your broader point, despite that sort of the impact of that historical problem of boundaries, it is obvious that the long-term solution to instability in South Asia, Pakistan, Afghanistan, India to some extent, and also to Southwest Asia and Iran, must be regional. And it's not going to happen overnight. It's not going to happen tomorrow. But it certainly does mean that we are going to have to be very, very practical about what all of our core vital interests are, what sorts of trade-offs we may be willing to make, what our absolute red lines are, and there are going to have to be some very long-term negotiations. My basic fear for Afghanistan, one that I do not have for Iraq, I have to say, is that there are a variety of players in the region that have an interest in Afghanistan remaining weak, even if they do not have an interest in Afghanistan imploding altogether. And then there are also other states, particularly Iran, that don't have much of an incentive to help us right now, although they have shown a willingness in the past, particularly in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. So we have an opportunity to help reset some of the strategic calculi of all the players in the region, but it's going to take some very smart diplomacy, and also going to be probably going to require us to make some hard trade-offs as well.
And I think what the caller is emphasizing, I think we tend to agree with this, is that you need to have a regional approach, that a key part of that is trying to find common interests among the regional players, to try to identify and then to emphasize and build on those common interests. There's two ways we can do that. If we truly take that to heart, what we would try to do is build some sort of regional approach, which is to say approach that is not centered on U.S. priorities, but tries to redefine priorities in light of what everybody might want to accomplish in common. That would be a dramatic change in how we conduct diplomacy. People have said this is America's war. Well, it certainly isn't America's war in the sense that we are the only ones affected. We and the Afghanis and the Pakistanis, everyone in the region and in the world is affected. So in that sense, it's everyone's war. But in terms of who controls the levers of activity now, it is principally America's war. We're in the lead. If we want to develop, identify those common interests and really try to bring other people in, it means allowing a situation to evolve where we are not at the center of everything and our priorities are not at the center of everything. That means trying to find out what Pakistan's aims are, Iran's aims, what the aims of our European allies are, and to try to find some sort of middle ground there.
And so right now, those are the things that we don't have. We don't know what their aims are, and we really haven't looked at a comprehensive picture of what an economic and infrastructure development plan would be. So,
I would say it is principally a question of is our idea of diplomacy one where we try to get everybody aboard our train, or is our approach one where we try to find a train that everybody is agreeable to, and it is not in any sense any longer America's war?
We do have another caller online. We'll go to our caller. Thank you for calling.
Is this my turn?
Yes, it is.
Question for either of your guests. 30 years ago, I knew very well a man who I understand now is casting about to see whether he should make a run for the presidency of Afghanistan against Mohammad Karzai. I'm sure either of your guests know him or know about him, Ashraf Ghani, and I'm wondering if either of them have an opinion about whether he would be a positive contribution to the situation and how much of a chance he might have if he does run.
No, thank you for your call.
This is Ruben. I know Dr. Ghani. I know him pretty well. As I can say personally, I have enormous respect for him, both for his intellect and also for his personal integrity. I think that Afghanistan would be very lucky to have him as president. Now, that said, I cannot speak enough or intelligently about the nature of local Afghan politics to know to sort of make odds, as it were, on his ability to become elected. But he has served in the government before. He was the finance minister early on in the Karzai administration. He has an intimate knowledge of the country, of its financial issues and its social issues, and I think that he had a lot to bring back to his people.
Out of curiosity, what kind of development plan would he have in mind for Afghanistan?
I don't want to speak too much for him. I will simply sort of talk a little bit about some of the ideas I've heard him express before. He is one of the founders of something called the National Solidarity Program, which is basically a mechanism to, instead of funneling all development assistance through the central government out through the provinces, basically gives small block grants to local villages and encourages those villagers to decide amongst themselves what they think their major development priorities are, and then to fund them and then potentially get more funding up to the provincial level necessary. And that has a couple of different effects. One is it has the impact of spreading development assistance all throughout the country. You can think about it as sort of a larger version of a sort of micro-lending that was pioneered by Muhammad Yunus in Bangladesh and other places. It also has the benefit of providing something of a governmental face throughout most of the country. It also has the profound benefit of building local buy-in and giving local responsibility, and also in some sense actually sort of helping to build local governance, because villagers have to come together and decide jointly how they want to spend.
Unification plan, more or less.
Exactly. So so that's sort of one thing from a micro level I know he's very concerned about. From a macro level, I also know he's very concerned about the need to build out both the agricultural infrastructure and doing the sorts of big infrastructural investment, whether it be roads or grain silos or these sorts of things which are necessary to both move agricultural products from field to market and have the support infrastructure along the way. I also know he's very much interested in helping and trying to find ways to develop regional water resources from Afghanistan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and other ways, both to provide enough water to irrigate fields, but also, more importantly, to harness the vast amount of hydroelectricity that is available in that region of the world to power, provide electricity, and therefore be a motive of engine of economic growth. One last thing I will say that I know he's very passionate about is education. The educational facilities in Afghanistan at the vocational university level are abysmal. There's not a single university there which reaches even the most minimal standard of international education. And in order to provide the youth in Afghanistan some sense of their future, both for a reason to stay in Afghanistan and also to have other productive activities other than engaging in armed conflict, it is vitally important to improve training and educational opportunities for them there.
Carl, was there anything you wanted to add?
Yeah, I think that the principal issue here is that whoever leads Afghanistan has got to reflect to some extent a political consensus in the country, and has got to have deep roots probably means some substantial tribal roots as well. And I'm not sure that Dr. Ghani really connects there. I think he may have been in the best position as Minister of Finance, that I think his vision of development is a proper one. But the real question here, stability is not simply going to be a question, or even principally a question, of what the central government in Afghanistan does. It's an important component, but the principle is going to be, can you create a political consensus in the country that draws in all of, or most of, the various tendencies? And the strength that Karzai has at this point is that he is a recognized national leader who is well connected. And it will be interesting to see how others, in an open and fair election, how others are able to compete with him. The real issue then becomes one of sort of the technically competent person versus the person who has strong popular appeal outside of the capital. I don't know that Karzai is the best in that way, in that sense either. I don't know if there is anyone, but he may be the strongest of the contenders. We will see. I think the important thing to keep in mind is that stability depends on reaching a political accommodation between the various actors. And it is not principally going to be a question of good development decisions coming from the central government.
Well, thank you both for taking the time. We've been speaking with Carl Canetta and with Ruben Brighetti, and we hope to have you come back, and we'll speak more to include a little bit more about the political situation in Pakistan, as well as their economic issues and hopes and dreams. Thank you so much for giving us your time.
Yep, thank you very much.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 here in the city, 91.9 in the Willamette River Valley, in the Gorge, 107 on the web, www.kboo.fm. This was More Talk Radio. I am Celeste Carey. Stay tuned, because coming up at 9 o'clock is the Old Mole, and Old Mole Bill Resnick is going to speak with Russell Mokaiba, who is the ace corporate crime reporter for the Multinational Monitor, about the crimes of healthcare companies and their role in the Obama healthcare reform package. 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia. Local news and commentary with Chris Andre and Liam Delta. 10:15, if you love this planet, Dr. Oliver Fine, who is the president of Physicians for a National Health Program, who will outline their proposal for a one-payer system for health care here in the U.S. And, of course, at 11 o'clock with Dr. David Naiman, who will interview Cheryl Tilger, or is it, yeah, Tilgner, there we go, naturopathic physician, herbalist, founder of Wise Woman Herbals, and author of Herbal Medicine from the Heart of the Earth. And then at 11:30, your talk by Amory Lovins of the Rocky Mountain Institute on Energy Efficiency. All that and more on your community connection, KBOO Portland.
a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland, Oregon 90.7. This is listener-supported community radio. It's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this March 16th Monday. Tammy Dean is our engineer. Well, it is a collective labor that brings you the Old Mole every Monday morning at 9 a.m. We are moles in the ground, digging at the roots of polite society, stirring up the dirt on the global capitalist system, and examining the democratic movements that seek to challenge capitalism in a collective struggle to build a better world for all. Today on The Old Mole, Bill Resnick talks with Russell Machaber. He's a corporate crime reporter for Multinational Monitor. They'll discuss the crimes of healthcare companies and their role in the Obama healthcare reform package. I will be joined by movie mole Jan Hawken for a review of the film XXY. This is not your conventional coming-of-age story. XXY explores the challenges faced by an intersex adolescent raised as a girl as she confronts her emerging sexuality. In the second half hour of the show, Jan Hawken interviews Renee Lertzman. She is a researcher at the Cardiff School of Social Sciences in Wales. Her work focuses on psychology and environmental issues. They will look at what psychology can teach activists and educators about public responses to ecological threats. And Bill Resnick returns later with a conversation with an activist in New York about the continuing struggle by workers at the Stella d'Oro bakery in the Bronx. Workers went on strike in August 2008 and have found a broad base of community support as they challenge new ownership's attempts to drive down wages and gut benefits. Remember, you can find us on the web. Look for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm. And now, we're ready to go with Bill Resnick and Russell Machaber.
Hi, thanks, Denise. Russell Machaber, welcome to KBOO.
Good morning.
Let me introduce you. Russell Machaber writes a lot for Multinational Monitor, and he puts out, he's the publisher and chief researcher, actually, of Corporate Crime Reporter. Russell, before we get to the latest battle for affordable national health care, that is the Obama initiative, tell us about the health industry. How do they rank in terms of corporate criminality? Up there with oil and banking?
It's hard to make an objective case that they're in second or third place.
Yeah.
The health insurance industry would be, the private health insurance industry is engaged in criminal activity by its own existence. I mean, most countries have laws that make it illegal for private health insurance companies to sell health insurance, to be in business. And Congressman John Conyers has introduced legislation in the U.S. Congress, H.R. 676, which has 60 co-sponsors or so, that would make their business illegal and,
mm-hmm.
you know, effectively give them the death penalty and put them out of business. That is why that they are clinging to Obama's plan. The situation in Washington is that the health insurance industry is spreading around its millions in the political system so as to guarantee that there's no single-payer Medicare for all system. And so if you say, to be a player in Washington, you have to say no to single-payer. And if you say single-payer, you're not generally not heard. This despite the fact that the majority of Americans in a CBS poll last year, 60% of Americans said they favor single-payer national health insurance. The majority of doctors in polling favor it. This is a big change from just as recently as 10 years ago when maybe only 30% of doctors favored it. The majority of nurses and the majority of health economists, and most surprisingly in a Zogby poll last year, the majority of small businesses favor it. So then the question becomes, if this is the case, why isn't it breaking through? And it's not breaking through because it would put this industry out of business, and they're very powerful. So we've set up a group called singlepayeraction.org. And single payer, you can go and sign up, and we're our goal is to sign up 1 million Americans, and we think 1 million Americans getting active, that is pressuring their members of Congress with demonstrations in front of their home offices,
right,
will get the job done.
Russell, I know you did a big march. In fact, I want to get back to that near the end of our. You're taking the gloves off, sort of. It seems to me. Also, I mean, these are really effective big marches. Not just arguing policy by politely, but let's get to that near the end of the interview, and start with the industry. They're, you know, the estimate is there that, and it's not an estimate. It's actually really good research, and nobody contests. 100,000 people die a year. That's like one big Boeing jet going down. 300 people dying every day of preventable things in hospitals. I mean, it's quite extraordinary, both from overcare, right, and from undercare. Some people won't really treat them because they don't have insurance and money, and some who have big insurance and money get everything, including things, of course, that kill them because they so over test and medicate them and
the
charge for it.
The other number that hits home is. The number 22,000, that's according to a National Institutes of Medicine study just updated last year, 22,000 Americans die every year from not having health insurance. And I think the reason this is such a powerful issue is because every American has a story. I mean, personally, I'm self-employed. I pay about $2,000 a quarter. That's about $8,000 a year for a family of four. And it's a catastrophic policy. That means there's a $5,400 deductible, and so the insurance company pays nothing until I pay $5,400.
Right.
That's one. And the second is there are all these loopholes. Like when I was thrown into hospital a couple years ago, I was told after I got out that the hospital was in my network, but the doctor who performed the surgery was out of network.
Ah.
So. you know, one of the arguments against single payer is it takes away freedom of choice.
That's absurd. Yeah.
But in fact, what's happening now is we have very little choice, and the regulation is on where we can go and what we can do is being imposed by the health insurance industry under single payer. So single payer would eliminate the 200 or so health insurance companies. They would be gone. It would be replaced by one payer. Doctors and hospitals would be paid by one payer, like a Medicare kind of payer. And it would save about 40% in administrative costs
alone, right,
over the current system. And then you would get a card as an American citizen. You would get a card, and you could go to any doctor, any hospital in the country. So it would give you total choice. You could go anywhere you want.
Right.
Right now, it's very limited within your area and within your network. And sometimes there are these gaping holes. So even if you're in a hospital that's in network, people who are providing the services are out of network, and you get stuck with the bill.
And there's some fine print that shows that they're right, that the health insurance company. You know, I had dinner with a doctor this weekend, and she said, what's incredible now is the amount of paperwork that they have to go through and arguing and on the phone with the insurance company. They spend like a quarter to a third of their time, medical people, arguing and having fights and filling out the forms. 200 different forms, of course, for each insurance company. You know, some of it is impossible to do. It's an incredible, incredible waste that these people have perpetrated on us.
Well, and that's what's driving doctors nuts. But the thing about the other thing about this system is there are 14,000 Americans being thrown off insurance every day because of the recession that we're in.
Yeah, you know, that gets us though to the second point. Let me do a station ID. This is KBOO Radio 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick for the Old Mole, talking to Russell Machaber, who writes Corporate Crime Reporter and writes a whole lot of really interesting things in Multinational Monitor. He keeps up with the corporate sector. Yes, the people are being thrown off of insurance very rapidly because companies are don't want to go through the cost, and they're in control, and people are desperate for jobs, and they do what they want, without especially non-unionized firms, most of them. So the insurance companies, though, right, and the hospitals and the doctors and the pharmaceutical companies, all of them, are starting to lose money because so few people, I mean, without people being covered by these plans, they can't collect from them. People are getting poorer. So, in fact, they now want a national health system, right, but one that serves them.
Well, that's why we have a chance of winning this.
Tell us that whole story.
The stars are starting to align.
Yeah, it's such an interesting story. Tell us the whole story. Start at the beginning, sort of.
Well, I think most amazing is this Zogby poll, because traditionally small businesses are very conservative politically, and their lobbying group in Washington is perhaps one of the more conservative politically lobbying groups inside the Beltway. And yet, here they are, the majority of them, realizing that these health insurance costs are killing them. And even big business, they say that General Motors is more of a health insurance company now than an automobile company.
That is their expenditure.
Because of their costs. And anybody who's been to Detroit knows if you cross the river into Windsor, Ontario, Canada, you're in a country that has single-payer national health insurance. And General Motors would be a totally different company if they were just a few miles east. So businesses are starting to come around, but also just the human pain and the fear. Like myself and my own family, and this is true for probably the majority of Americans, we think twice about going to a doctor, even if we think we need it. I mean, some people fear doctors, and some people think that it's an awful, the profession has been corrupted by pharmaceutical industry money and so forth, which it has.
Which it has, yeah.
But the reality is, if you need a doctor, you fear financial ruin and personal bankruptcy once you enter the system. And one of the more recent studies on personal bankruptcy found that more than half of all personal bankruptcies now are triggered by medical costs.
Russell, let's get to the fight in Washington now.
This is really interesting.
Let me say one thing. One of the reasons is that the companies now say, we want a national health plan, but it's because they want to insure everybody and get government money for their fantastically expensive and highly profitable system. But tell us, how is that working out in the Obama initiative?
Well, the amazing thing about, and it's been an eye opener since we started singlepayeraction.org.
Mm-hmm.
One of the kinds of emails we're getting is on our website we post an article titled "Obama to Single Payer Advocates Drop Dead," and we actually broke this story a couple weeks ago when we reported that Congressman Conyers, who's the author of the legislation, was at a Congressional Black Caucus meeting at the White House two Thursdays ago, and he stood up and he asked the president why single-payer advocates were being shut out from his summit, which was the following week. And he had a summit where he had 150 experts on health care. Now, remember, this single-payer issue is supported by the majority of American people, majority of doctors, majority of nurses, majority of health economists, and majority of small businesses. And out of 150 people who were invited, not one was a single-payer advocate.
Uh-huh.
So Kanye stood up and said, could you please explain this? And the president said, well, I'll look into it and get back to you. Conyers got an email the next day from a White House staffer saying, no single-payer advocates at the summit, period. So when we posted this article, there was an uproar, and Physicians for a National Health Plan, the doctors group that supports single-payer, announced that they were going to picket the White House on the day of the summit. So this started bouncing around the web, and the White House calls Conyers to say, okay, you can come. And not enough for the doctors, and they said, okay, the head of the Physicians for a National Health Program could come. And the doctors called off the protest as if it was a victory, and they claimed victory. So two out of 150 people who went to the summit supported single payer. I think that only one of them spoke. Congressman Conyers reportedly did not speak. So this is what we have. Now, the Obama position was no surprise to those of us who followed his campaign. There were so many things that the American people cared about that Obama put off the table, including single-payer, during the campaign. So, but the amazing thing was the emails we got. We love single payer. We want single payer, but take off that attack of Obama on your website, or we're not going to support you, because Obama favors single payer. He might be in the closet on it, but he favors it. Now, our position is that if Obama favors single payer, he has to show some leadership, because this is the hot button issue of the day. People need it. People want it. People are dying for it. Literally,
yeah.
22,000 Americans a year are dying for lack of health insurance, and probably a lot more because they're underinsured.
Yeah, you know, Obama, though, and his boys, realists, they call themselves, and pragmatic, they have the idea that they're going to be able to tame the health industry, because the health industry is now in trouble because, you know, people can't pay for health care anymore and the companies are backing out, are dropping it. They seem to think that they can force the health care companies into a bargain that would ultimately lead to sort of nonprofit health care, and where the public would get so much more power over them that they could finally, tame the industry like you would want to tame
right.
a.
But I was talking about that. I was talking about that with a doctor in Ohio, who's a single payer doc, and he said, "Well, Obama's plan is like Obama's treating." Assume that the health insurance industry is like a vicious dog. Obama's plan kicks it in the face when you got to put it out of its misery.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you kick in its face, it's going to come off and rip your head off.
You know, there's that great line, the tawny line, you can peel an onion leaf by leaf, but you can't subdue a tiger claw by claw. They're vivisectionists. That is, they're meat eaters. They'll eat you first. And I'm afraid that's what's going to happen to Mr. Obama, actually, and the health plan. This is KB Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Russell McIver, who writes Corporate Crime Reporter and publishes it, and writes a lot for Multinational Monitor on the health industry. We only have another sort of minute and a half. Tell us about single-payer action. You did a recent demonstration. It's clearly an organization that's going to really put the pressure on and be out there in the streets, like on May Day, I hope. Big rallies here and everywhere in the world, actually. Tell us about single-payer action.
Well, our probably fewer than 5% of Americans know where their member of Congress have their district office. So what we're promoting people to get to know their member of Congress district office and to camp out and to start having actions there. Here, you're calling me in my hometown of Berkeley Springs, West Virginia, where it's the second district, and our member of Congress, Shelley Moore Capito, is opposed to single payer. And so we are going to be, you know, our people have met with her, and she said, no, health insurance plans and this blah, blah, blah. And so we're going to be picking her offices here until she changes her mind. The first action is going to be at the end of the month, when we are going to, there's a group of belly dancers here going to do something called Shakedown for Single Payer.
Well, that'll get the newspapers there.
That's going to get some local publicity.
Uh-huh.
And these are the kinds of things that are happening. There's going to be direct confrontation. We burned in honor and in memory of the 22,000 Americans who will die this year for lack of insurance. A group of us from Single Payer Action burned our health insurance bills. That video is up at singlepayeraction.org.
Oh boy, it really is a campaign that could be really visual and really fun and really hard hitting.
We don't think the emails are going to do it. The email campaigns are going to do it. It's going to have to be face to face, direct action, direct confrontation. So come to singlepayeraction.org. Sign up, donate. We're building for a million, and we're going to do it all around the country. It's going to be a lot of fun, and we're going to get it done because the American people and business are for this, and it's a winnable issue, and we're going to win it.
Thanks a lot for talking to us today, Russell.
Thank you.
Right. So long.
I need my conscience.
Animal Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host this morning, and I'm here with Jan Hawken to review the film XXY. This film was released actually in 2007 and slowly made it through Europe to and out and about to the United States, but it was very limited release, but is now available on DVD, so we are giving folks a little taste of what they might find if they rent the film. Very interesting film, directed by Argentine writer and filmmaker Lucia Puenzo. It's a very unconventional coming-of-age story about Alex, a 15-year-old girl living in a small coastal village with her parents. Alex is a tomboy, she's a vegetarian, and she has a pet lizard, and she's, in many ways a very typical teen. But she also has a secret that she lives with, and this is not the kind of secret that drives the engine of Hollywood film, but it's the kind of secret a character might keep or risk the loss of self-determination. Alex has both male and female genitals, and at her birth, her parents declined to have her normalized through surgery, but she has been taking medication to suppress development of male characteristics. And now, as she's well into puberty, her emerging sexuality and desire forces the question. Mother invites a doctor and his family to meet Alex and explore the option of surgery. Alex and Alvaro, the doctor's son, develop a friendship and an attraction, and through this relationship, the teens explore sexual desire and identity outside the confines of convention. The director, Lucia Puenzo, has written several novels and television screenplays, but XXY is her first feature film, and the film was inspired by a short story that deals with intersexuality. And a quote from her, I think, gives us a sense of where she was coming from and what she was working with while she was making this film. Quote, "From the moment I read that story, the sexual awakening of a young girl who has what doctors call genital ambiguity, I couldn't take it out of my head. I was especially interested in the dilemma of inevitable choice, not only having to choose between being a man or a woman, but also having to choose between a binary decision and intersex as an identity, and not just a place of mere passage." Well, Jan, there's been a lot of emerging activism and writing and literature about intersexuality and kind of modernizing and bringing things into kind of a contemporary sense about sexuality and what our sense of that is now. And you, as a psychologist, are deeply interested in those questions and have some things to offer before we actually talk about the film.
Yeah. Somewhat of a sexologist myself. I mean, there's one set of questions that have to do with the rights and claims of people who fall outside of this, the binary distinction between male and female, and the whole history of medical intervention to achieve congruence and to establish a conformity between the individual and one of those two categories. And there's been a lot of controversy over that and kind of a movement toward delaying decisions and a more complicated process. The American Psychological Association has very lengthy guidelines now for parents on how to think about it, include recognizing there's controversy about doing it at all, and that there's an intersex community, which is quite remarkable that there is that position recognized by the APA, that there is the right of a third sex to be its own category. But there's also this debate in the queer community, trans community, and in feminist literature in general about how fluid and socially constructed sexuality is versus how much it's important to recognize the right of people to be one or the other. But then there's also another whole debate about what these people represent to others. And in looking at the film, we might question what captures the audience, what anxieties and uncertainties are mobilized in watching this coming-of-age story and knowing that she has genitals of both sex, which one might say is disturbing in different ways, but maybe that's something to talk about, what she represents.
Yeah, it's interesting because that question, I think, is central to the difference between what the film does and the character the film represents and the title itself, XXY, which is a very specific syndrome. And some have been a little bit critical of the film for using that, but the filmmaker kind of holds to a claim of, you know, symbolically that XXY is very powerful. And what she can do poetically in the film is to broaden the question about the actual person's different configuration of sexual intersexuality, let's say. So there's a much greater, a broader poetic license taken in the film than the title itself might lead us to.
Well, there's a kind of irony in that the XXY suggests there's kind of too much female, and most infants with sexually ambiguous genitalia are raised as female. I mean, the surgeons will say it's because it's easier to construct a vagina than a male genital, but it is. Or specifically the penis, but I think the issue of is it easier to raise a boy than a girl, it's kind of a complicated decision why so much tips towards a female. Yet in this film, it's that she has, quote, too much maleness rather than too much femaleness, that what is anxiety provoking is about her maleness, and it kind of overtakes her this assigned identity, social identity as female. I think why, you know, is the anxiety the same? I mean, in terms of tipping one way or the other, is I think an important question raised by the film.
I think so, and I think that as that character struggles with their own dilemma and challenges, everyone around her is also forced to kind of confront something. And I think the film really does something very well, which is it makes everybody's gender in flux. The men in the film are particularly the father and the young boy Alvaro that she has this relationship with and this friendship with. She has another young boy in the film that she has a friendship with. Their masculinity is so not that masculinity, that macho masculinity. And so
there's anxiety about adolescent sexuality and gender identity in general, like whether the son of the surgeon is homosexual and
right.
All of these. And you wonder, why is a surgeon doing this kind of work?
Right, that he repairs deformities. They mention somebody born with six fingers. Well, they get rid of the finger, you know, as if these are comparable. But it is interesting the way that gender does get kind of played out throughout with all of the characters. The mother is not overtly feminine in a way. They do certain kind of work. That is, the father is a marine biologist who saves different animals who have been injured by the fishing industry. So he's kind of does in some way a kind of care work. I mean, it's a very interesting mix that's going on. It helps us to see that it's not just one person whose gender is kind of doesn't fit into the real strict binary of male and female, that there's a lot of fluidity for everyone around us. And so the parents are susceptible to the idea that that their child should be allowed to kind of exist maybe in that space of intersexuality and not have to make a choice. But it's a conflict, and it has to kind of be resolved through these different channels in the film.
The film departs from kind of the classical parent-child conflict, and that these are parents who really allow tremendous latitude in that area. And yet, as a kind of progressive parental stance, that is, that you let the child decide and see it emerge, I think there is a moment in the film where the tipping point, where the father sees his daughter, he's been thinking of the daughter, and as the child is a daughter, having sex, and then comes this point that his daughter really is a son. And I think one reading of this scene is that there is a kind of essential underlying masculinity that's more sexually pressing, more perhaps predatory, more insistent, that will emerge during adolescence and define whether you're more essentially male or female. And I found that problematic, even though this was a very progressive kind of parental position they were taking, because they were really trying to negotiate.
Well, it's interesting because I read that at a little bit more progressive, maybe. But my experience of that was, you know, that for women to, you know, of course, express any kind of aggressive sexuality is sort of taboo. And her having male genitals, having a penis, does not give her the kind of entitlement in the culture that you're supposed to be granted by having it. So there's a lot of playing, there's a lot going on with that, I think, symbolically. Then there's the question of Alvaro, the friend that she has the sexual encounter with. His sexuality is in flux. We can, one, say, well, he's homosexual, but also we can question whether or not he just is flexible, as young people can be, to the idea of experiencing desire for someone who doesn't fit in that one thing. So we, you know, I think there's a mix of things going on there in the way that we see her, the way that we see the her and the him maybe interacting in that scene. I mean, there's a lot of ways I suppose we could talk about it, but we, you know, maybe should let people see more of it before we give too much away. But I do think that one of the more interesting pieces of this for me is really this question about entitlement and about what you get when you have male parts, and that really not functioning within the culture in the way that
because
you would expect.
Because she was not so socially defined as male. And one feminist reading is that masculinity is always more precariously perched, you know, than and held together than is acknowledged. That it's an achievement that where there's this fantasy of power and autonomy, but that it's also a precarious it's a precarious achievement, and that this kind of underscores that point.
Yeah, and I think one interesting thing too is that, you know, in film it's very taboo to even to show the male body in full, where we see female bodies all the time, and I think there may be a little playing around with this that goes on, just that thing about it, the mystery that shrouds the member, and the whole question about do you see it,
and
not see it. It's very interesting, really great film. And Jan, you'll be looking at another great film next week as well.
Yeah, Che. It's still playing at Cinema 21. It's a four hour movie, and try to see it this week when you can see it at the Cozy Independent Theater of Cinema 21, all in 4 hours before it goes to the Mega Metroplex somewhere.
Right.
In two sessions. So we'll be talking about that next week.
Great. Well, we've been talking about XXY. It's an Argentine film. Lucia Puenzo is the director. Really great film. You can find it on DVD. We really recommend it. And lots of great stuff to dig around out there on the internet to get lots of opinions and insights on that one. So thanks, Jen. We've got lots of good stuff coming up later on the old, not on the old mole, but on KBOO. At 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia, local news and commentary with Chris Andre and Liam Delta. At 10:15 on If You Love This Planet, the guest is Dr. Oliver Fenn, president of Physicians for a National Health Program. He outlines their proposal for one-payer system. At 11, it's Health Watch with Dr. David Naiman. And at 11:30, it is Amory Levins of the Rocky Mountain Institute on energy efficiency. But we are back to the old mole now. We'll go to Bill Resnick, who is going to talk about the strike in New York, the Stella D'Oro Bakery. And, Bill, are you ready?
Thanks, Denise. Hi, Michael Landau. Welcome to KBOO.
Hi, Bill. Thanks for having me on.
Micah Landau is a community activist. He's on the strike support committee of the Stella D'Oro strike in New York City. It's really quite a fascinating strike, and it brings together these two groups of society. On the one side, a hedge fund. On the other side, a group of basically women of color, mostly Hispanic, and some men. Tell us about the Stella D'Oro strike.
Well, I mean, the strike in the context of, like, the Oak Harbor strike that we recently saw with 600 Teamsters on strike, it may seem at first glance like a small thing. It's 136 workers, some of whom are skilled, some of whom are unskilled, you know, who pack the cookies literally into boxes at Stella D'Oro, which is a bakery in the Bronx. So it's not teeny. I mean, 136 workers on strike now for 7 months.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not, at first glance, huge. The significance of this strike is that basically they came up against a new management of Stella D'Oro, which is kind of a longtime Italian cookie brand in New York, but it's distributed nationally. And the managers wanted to cut their wages by 28% from $18 to $13 an hour, make them pay 20% on their health care, take away a week of vacation, all 12 sick days they get, and 4 holidays. And so this is just kind of the most brutal gutting of benefits that the union there, the Bakers Union, BCTGM Local 50, has acquired over years and years. And it's a private equity firm, Brinwood Partners. That was the new management.
The new management. It used to be Kraft and Kraft Nabisco, right? First it was independent, then Kraft bought them. And then, but Kraft was unionized and was paying sort of decent salaries, right? So this hedge fund, Brinwood Partners, this hedge fund bought then Stella D'Oro from Kraft, right? And they thought, I'm sure, these people are making $18 an hour with benefits, which in New York City is not enough to live. But in any event, they were making $18 an hour. Why not force them down to close to the minimum wage is what they thought. And we could get all the money out of it, right? That was Brinwood's strategy.
I think it's even more nefarious than that. I mean, the company was, you know, it was a family business for years and years and years, since the 30s when it was opened. And then in the 90s, because of some trouble with the family that owned it, and some personal reasons, they sold it to Nabisco, which was then bought by Kraft.
Right.
And in 2006, Brinwood Partners entered the scene. And the first thing Brinwood Partners did was they forced the Teamsters, who were the distributors, the drivers, were represented by Teamsters Local 550, they forced them out on strike.
Uh-huh.
They gave them a list of contract demands that they knew the Teamsters couldn't accept. The guys had no choice but to go on strike, so 25 Teamster drivers went on strike, and after 7 weeks on strike, they were beat. You know, they went to their local and they said, we've lost, you know, get us a good deal. And most of them then shipped out to other Teamster shops.
Uh-huh.
So we see from that the goal wasn't just to squeeze. Now they've waited from 2006 till this past August, when they were again in contract negotiations, now with the folks who worked inside the bakery. It seems that they were waiting for the contract to come up so they could do the same thing, force people on strike, not just drive their wages down, but in fact break the union. They want them to come back with lower wages and without a union.
Mm-hmm.
So it's more than just squeezing these workers for extra money. It's really to break the dynamic in the workplace,
right,
too.
But in fact, Brinwood ran into a tougher group to beat down, and in fact, ultimately, a really large community group. There now is really a fight, right? Tell us about it.
Yeah, absolutely. So their contract had expired in July, and in August, Brinwood gave this ridiculous, you know, proposal for a new contract that I said some of the really nasty things that they wanted from the workers. August 13th, the workers, it was the company's first and final offer.
Uh-huh.
And so workers had no choice. On August 13th, they walked out, and for several months, they were basically standing on the picket line through the winter, through December in the cold,
mm-hmm.
You know, without much support, because the union is just understaffed. It's a small local. It hasn't really been able to support them in the ways that they needed. But after that, starting in December, some folks who lived in the neighborhood, you know, took notice that this was going on, and they began having meetings, and they built up a community strike support group, which has really done some incredible work. On January 31st, for example, the strike support group organized a rally that we estimate had as many as 500 people. Major TV cameras, you know, mm-hmm. news stations were there. We've been able to get enough media coverage that we need consistent media coverage, and we need to consistently be bringing in money. And those are the two basic things in order to keep this fight up. I mean, after 7 months, people are very tired, but if we can keep the public eye on the strike and we can keep fundraising coming in, we have the basis to continue the fight.
Tell me about the way community support was organized. How did that happen? Because that's the key now for those in the labor movement who really want to fight, who are just aren't trying to preserve their pensions as long as they can. The key is, in fact, becoming a larger movement, a social union movement, and a voice for the people. But how did that happen in the Bronx?
Well, I think
in Morrisania,
there were two different channels. I think from the very beginning, you know, PSC, the Professional Staff Congress, is kind of an activist-minded union of professors in the city university system, and some of their folks independently who teach it, like Hostos, which is, you know, a college up in the Bronx, came around the strike, and they started working, you know, just on their own, this small group of professors doing. They had a Christmas party for the children of the strikers. They were raising money. They were trying to get it in the union newspapers. They were going to the Central Labor Council. At the same time, folks who'd been working on another project previously to supporting teachers in Puerto Rico and mm-hmm. doing support work for them in New York all kind of migrated together as a group to help the folks at Stoladoro. And it just went from there. We found a church that was willing to give us the space to meet. We contacted different community groups. We ultimately contacted Jobs with Justice. And the group is kind of, as we've had bigger and bigger events and rallies, and there's this spirit, you know, this spirit that's been revived that was really dying on the line. On Wednesday, we had a rally up there, and folks actually got in the way of cars. It was scabs were trying to come into the lot to go to work. People got in the way of the cars, and somebody would go to the window of the car and say, you know, you're not going to work today. These are our jobs. You should be out here with us. You're getting screwed, too. And those kinds of things have created this spirit, which has drawn more and more people in. And the group has been working to keep that momentum alive. And we're also organizing pickets all around the city, just trying to get visibility going.
Yeah, you know, we're about 3,000 miles away here in Portland. What can we do? This is sort of the final bit.
Well, I think that the most important thing that we're trying to do is, as we know, picketing outside a bakery that's still a factory, in fact, that's still in production with scabs inside, we missed the moment to really stop production right there. They're at about 35% production is what we've been, uh-huh. we've estimated. But the
30 more seconds, Micah, we have to get off the air. Tell us.
Okay, the thing that folks can do is if Stop and Shop, Food Emporium, any of these kind of supermarkets that sell Stoladoro, deliver mm-hmm. a letter to management. We can get letters to people and pick at the stores. Tell them you're not going to shop there or that.
Yeah, just go on their website and tell them no more Stoladoro cookies. And other things. We could send money, too, if you go to the website. Thank you very much for talking, Micah.
Thank you for having me on, Bill.
Right, so long.
Bye.
This is Jan Hawken with the Old Mole Variety Hour here on KBOO Portland Community Radio. I have Renee Lertzman on the line. Renee, are you there?
I am. Hi.
Hi. Renee Lertzman is a researcher at Cardiff University in Wales and is here on the show today to talk about psychology and ecological crises. And this is an area where you've been working as an academic and with activist interests for some time, is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes, in communications mainly.
Well, you take up some of the common wisdom about psychological or emotional responses to the environmental or ecological crises. Could you tell us a little bit about what some of the common psychological thinking is, or understandings of the psychology of this problem?
Yeah, well, particularly for those working in the environmental sector, I think the most prevailing notion is and source of frustration is a sense of apathy. You hear a lot about public apathy and barriers basically for trying to engage different publics and communities in responding to these issues. And so what I'm looking at is really what is the apathy about, what is underlying that, and ultimately trying to dismantle the notion of apathy to say that actually there's some powerful emotional, psychological dynamics basically going on when we're having to deal and confront the magnitude of our environmental ecological situation.
So perhaps apathy, like boredom or laziness, those also are terms that need to be unpacked because they cover a lot of kind of underlying complex psychological and social phenomena.
Right. And there's an equation between a lack of engagement and a lack of action with a lack of care or concern or worry. And so what I'm looking at is actually the role of anxiety and other powerful experiences and emotional responses to environmental issues that may indeed lead to what appears to be apathy, you know, to appears to be a lack of anything, kind of a blankness.
Well, what is the practical or applied value of a better diagnosis, one might say? You know, you're bringing a more refined diagnostic lens to the issues, but would it be fair to say that this may not help us in an organized response to a crisis that is terrifying?
Right. Well, I think that it's actually essential that we develop more psychologically sophisticated and nuanced understanding of what might be happening for people. And this has everything to do with how we do outreach, how we construct communication strategy. It's basically, rather than assuming that you're working against the flow and that people don't care, kind of trying to invert that, to ask the question, well, what if we assume that perhaps people care very much but are paralyzed or overwhelmed or feeling scared and feeling anxious? And so if we think about this as an analyst, a psychoanalyst or a psychotherapist would respond to a client or a patient who's struggling and feeling stuck, you know, we wouldn't necessarily shout and bombard that person with all kinds of facts about their damaging or destructive behavior. We would actually try to work with ways to mobilize their own kind of abilities to respond constructively. And so practically speaking, we could say that we can begin by acknowledging that, you know, there are these responses, that these issues are anxiety-provoking, that they may bring up a lot of grief or guilt. Guilt is a really big part of all of this because it's. I don't know if we can avoid guilt that may come up when we are faced with, you know, basically looking at what we've done on many levels ecologically. But the question is really, what do we do with the guilt? How do we work with it in a way to support people to become more proactive?
So there is this sometimes implicit notion that activists have about the psychology of these problems. It seems like the most common way of handling it is to establish and create an opening for hope by emphasizing what people can do, that, you know,
exactly,
because the anxiety is just too late, the planet is too ruined, so people, you know, a lot of these interventions will emphasize this window of hope, that there are things people can do, but a lot of it is based on, like, an inconvenient truth is sort of confronting people with massive amounts of data that presumably would overwhelm their defenses against the seriousness of the problem.
Yeah.
You focus more on the emotional side of psychology than the kind of cognitive side, which seems like it's where much of the work is
been, yeah, exactly,
on the cognitive side.
Yeah, I think actually the emotional or the, you know, what could be called the affective dimensions are really important here, and certainly a cognitive approach is important too. But I guess where I'm coming from is that for messages of hope to be coherent and to be meaningful, that there needs to be somehow an acknowledgement of the emotional content, so that, in other words, we have to acknowledge that we're smart enough to know to make the connection between our individual actions and the bigger picture, and that, you know, where a lot of people get tripped up is precisely, well, I know that my light bulb buying farmers market lettuce, et cetera, is not going to make the difference. And so we need to find a way to kind of create bridges where we say, right, you know, to acknowledge the emotional response and to communicate the hope and the proactive and the really wonderful stuff that's going on and that you can do. So it's sort of, I sort of see it going hand in hand, that it's not all about, you know, just talking about the pain and the grief and all of that, but that the hopefulness to avoid falling into this kind of going to the other extreme where it's all positive, it's all kind of rah-rah. You know, I think that we, you know, as humans, we're smart enough to kind of see through some of that. And so, you
now,
know,
would
the,
be
the goal, I think, is to try to help people make those links.
Because the enormity of the problem opens space for a kind of sense of loss and more and catastrophic fears, which is a very basic human anxiety about death itself and the death
right.
of the world. I mean, the some of the scope of the problems as they're increasingly configured and portrayed are do stir up basic fears of catastrophe and annihilation, and I suppose in some mm-hmm. ways like the nuclear threat.
Exactly, yeah.
And the history of that. And are there things that we can learn from earlier struggles that have confronted fear on this scale and how people manage it? I mean, it seems like with this now, there's more about guilt and that we're implicated in it in a different way than with the nuclear threat.
Exactly, which makes it a lot harder because people get paralyzed with the guilt and attack the source of guilt, which is to say, you know, I don't want to hear about it, and going into denial. But I think we have so much to learn from the nuclear literature, actually. I mean, you know, there's been a lot of research done on the, you know, Robert J. Lifton's work on psychic numbing and the way that we struggle with these potentially apocalyptic threats. But, you know, I think one of the most important things really that came out of the nuclear movement was the shift from I to we, and basically shifting the discourse from individual that, you know, that it all rests on you to really focusing on the community, social, collective forms of response. So you saw the kind of affinity groups and, you know, that kind of thing happening, whereas I don't see that quite yet happening with the environmental discourse. It's still very much on what you can do as opposed to what we can do, although that's starting to change, especially with models like the Transition Town movement, which has just come to Portland from the UK and is really a different model.
Can you say
actually?
Can you say a bit about that and how it incorporates some of this kind of psychology, social psychology of the problem?
Well, I know that that they have a dimension of, you know, within the work on addressing peak oil and helping the community, working on a community level to shift to a more sustainable way of living in relation to energy and oil issues. I know that there's a heart and soul dimension that's like a kind of a strand within the model. And I think some communities have that more developed than others, and I know that it's definitely happening in Portland. And so what I see is, without being involved directly in it, is that they're trying to bring in that emotional and experiential level with the full recognition that comes out of Joanna Macy's work and some other activists who also came out of the nuclear movement, which is to say that, you know, it's very important that we have a space to feel what's happening and that actually can mobilize us, that we can move from feeling stuck and paralyzed I don't know if it's as simple as that. I mean, it's not necessarily cathartic about just having catharsis, but at least what's really exciting to me about it is that they are creating that space, which you just don't see in many environmental campaigns, and that's fine. You know, it's not that it always has to be there, but it's really incredible to me to see that this movement, which is now international, is making the effort to create that space and making the link between our own experiences as activists and as people just now coming, kind of awakening to these issues.
Now, when you say the international movement, you're speaking of, about the specific organization?
I'm speaking of the transition movement,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, because it started in the UK, but now it's springing up in cities all around the world.
So that there's there's the potential for turning inward as perhaps alternative communities as kind of islands of self-sufficiency, but you're saying that there is a way of acknowledging the emotional work involved alongside of political work.
Mm-hmm.
And creating experiments that also don't turn inward.
Yeah.
Away from the broader global. What?
It's a fine line.
I think that's one of the fears of psychology, and particularly kind of psychoanalytic perspectives. And taking the couch into the streets, the streets is cluttered with couches, not to overwork the metaphor, but the people are lying prone on those couches but are not up there, you know, marching. And
yeah, I think
so
that's really a false perception and dichotomy that has been hanging around for so long in terms of the theory practice or the cultural differences between activist communities and psychological communities. I think that is still very much alive, and that there's sort of an allergic reaction in both areas to one another.
And your interest is in kind of bridging those. And
exactly.
So we'll if you come to Portland, you may be coming here next year, and we hope to hear more about you, hear more of your work, as well as to perhaps hear you speak here in Portland. This is Jan Hocken talking today with Renee Lertzman, researcher at Cardiff University in Wales. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you. Thanks.
Well, we're wrapping it up this morning for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I have been your host, Denise Morris, and Tammy Dean has been our engineer. Remember, if you missed some or all of this program any week, you can hear it on the web. That's kboo.fm. And you can hear this show and other shows or parts of shows. And we always try to provide some good links and information, because that's what moles do. We dig around and we look for info, and we try to expose the roots of corruption and systemic oppression in society. It sounds depressing, but it can actually be kind of fun. We thank you for joining us, and we'll see you again next week.
Community radio station KBOO Portland, Oregon at 90.7 FM. Today is Monday, March 16th, 2009. And this is Air Cascadia, long on content, short on time. I'm Chris Andre.
And I'm Liam Delta.
Activists converged on Salem yesterday to tell legislators that we the people want to keep them the guard in Oregon.
So far, the only stimulus Oregon will see is more logging, renamed thinning, for the benefit of the green-minded.
And staggering insurance giant AIG has enraged the public by handing out taxpayers' money in the form of bonuses to the same people who caused the problem.
Portland area weather, rain, a little bit of hail and wind, temperatures in the 40s. Tonight, more rain, gusting winds, especially in the gorge and the coast, temperatures in the 30s and 40s, and more the same for the next few days.
And first we go to regional news from around Cascadia. First to Salem to talk with peace activist, Code Pink Corvallis member, and KBOO anti-war correspondent, Michelle Darr. Good morning, Michelle. Michelle has problems with her phone. She is a peace activist who has been sitting on the steps of the state capitol in Salem since November. Her circumstances there have changed. They're always difficult. Phones in particular. Michelle has been through a number of different cell phones, but just keeping a cell phone going due to shortage of funds has been a major problem for her. Contacting her is difficult. Media has interviewed her, mass media has interviewed her on a number of occasions, and it's always been problematic. We're going to try to get Michelle on the phone this morning to talk about the march in Salem on Sunday, and she'll be with us in just a moment. But until then, Liam, go ahead.
Today's the sixth anniversary of the killing of American peace activist Rachel Corrie by an Israeli military bulldozer in Rafah. She'd been trying to prevent the demolition of a Palestinian home near the border with Egypt. Last week, a women's peace delegation and Rachel's parents, Cindy and Craig Corrie, traveled to Gaza.
Federal stimulus money will soon pay for workers to thin northwest forests considered at risk for major wildfires. The U.S. Forest Service has awarded more than $12 million to 10 rural counties in Oregon and Idaho. Nan Christensen from the Forest Service in Missoula, Montana, says this is the first group of stimulus projects that her agency will fund. Oregon was also awarded about $3 million to hire high school and college-aged youth to do forest conservation and maintenance work during the next two summers. Well, Michelle is with us now. Good morning, Michelle.
Good morning, Chris.
Talk a little bit, if you would, about yesterday's Peace March.
Well, it was great. There were about 400 to 500 people out here, and it was a good show of solidarity for the National Guard to keep the National Guard home, and I thought it went very well.
Tokala, and also you have had a change in the nature of your vigil activities. Tell listeners, if you would, what's happened.
Well, we've been informed that what we need to do is to keep an awake vigil at night, which it was already quite difficult to, you know, have people out here who are willing to take the tickets that we were getting on a nightly basis for refusing to leave after 11 o'clock. So we've had to go ahead and end the nighttime part of it as, myself and the one other person who've been out here at night have been, you know, it's just not possible for us to stay awake all night and then expect to carry on, you know, the other activities we need to carry on during the day. So we're out here in the daytime and holding the vigil and, you know, working as hard as we can on, you know, keeping this issue in the forefront of the minds of the legislators. And today's a legislative lobbying day, so it's a really good day to call your legislators, call your senators and representatives and the governor's office, let them know that it's still really important to Oregonians to support the passage of HB 2556, HR 4, and SR 1.
Thank you so much. My guest has been Michelle Darr with Code Pink Corvallis. She's a peace activist and has been holding a vigil on the steps of the state capitol since November. Thanks again, Michelle.
Thank you, Chris. Bye.
At least six bills that target smoking and tobacco are making their way through the capitol this session, and the legislation runs the gamut. The Department of Human Services has introduced bills that would bar tobacco products from being sold in vending machines, require landlords to disclose their smoking policies, and implement a 60-cent-a-pack cigarette tax.
And it gets smokier.
The State Department of Environmental Quality says many Oregon students are riding to school in diesel-powered buses filled with potentially harmful fumes. According to the DEQ, more than two-thirds of the state's 5,200 school buses leak fumes through a hole in the crankcase or through tailpipe emissions. Okay, who can spell the word bicycle?
And that's not all they're inhaling. A new study of teen inhalant abuse suggests a need for more prevention and treatment. The government numbers show that fewer teens are sniffing glue, lighter fluid, shoe polish, and other substances. But it finds that the number of teens who actually abuse inhalants, as opposed to just giving them a try, has remained stable over the last 5 years.
Saturday night in downtown Portland, the Oregon ACLU held its annual gala. The atmosphere was all political, all party, all the time. I spoke with the guest of honor. Jim Hightower, thank you so much for being here in Portland with us. How do you feel about the prospects for civil liberties under the Obama administration?
Well, I think that was the whole message here tonight was we are optimistic, but wary. We have to be careful, and more than careful, we have got to be the force that pushes the Obama to be better than even he thinks he can be, because there are forces of repression, there are forces of suppression in terms of liberties all around him. And so there are 13,000 corporate lobbyists in Washington. There are a rabidly recalcitrant Republican regime in the Congress that wants to defeat him, wants to have him fail. There are weak-kneed Democrats who will not stand up. And so we have to stand up for him. The significant thing to me about Obama is that he represents the possibility of actual change. You know, even with Clinton, but certainly with Bush, we had no chance of change. We were fighting negative battles. Now we have a possibility of actually achieving something. And having that possibility gives us a special responsibility to be more aggressive and more demanding of real change, more demanding of liberties than we have been in the past. So our battle has just begun. The election of Obama was we have to wallow in that victory a little bit. I mean, because it was so extraordinary. It was so wonderful. But having done that, we cannot get all goosey about it. We now have to stand up, and we the people have got to be the force from the outside that demands, that counters the inside forces and demands that we actually make a difference.
So, in an optimistic beer and wine frame of mind, how many years do you think it might take to undo the damage done by the Bush administration?
Well, you know, they say that the worst job in circus is cleaning up after the elephants. And,
I love that.
and certainly, here we are. And that's begun. You know,
That was Jim Hightower, of course, speaking with me, and I am, of course, KBOO's Chris Andre. Ma'am?
Relatives say that immigration officials are trying to deport a dead man. They contend Nassim Mauricio Rivera died last August, but a deportation hearing against the native Salvadoran is still set for a hearing this summer.
No one can say we're not a nation of law and order. The Obama administration announced today that the 21 largest banks receiving government money must report monthly on how much lending they do to small businesses. All other banks getting taxpayer help are being asked to report quarterly on small business loans. Even banks that are not taking government funds are being told by the administration to make an extra effort to increase small business lending.
Reassuring comments on the economy from Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke sent stocks mostly higher today, giving the Dow and Standard & Poor's their fifth straight day of gains. Financial stocks again led the way.
Well, it looks like it might be working. On the other hand, the insurance giant AIG has gone ahead and handed out bonuses to the same people in the same department of the company whose bad decisions caused the company to implode, taking most of us with it. Americans are enraged over the action, but, hey, it's legal. KBOO Spencer Raymond joins us by phone this morning to make sense of it all. Good morning, Spencer.
Yeah, good morning, Chris. You're right. There are a lot of people outraged, both sides of the aisle on Capitol Hill, really upset over this, and it's really starting to question the motives of the Obama administration on future bailouts. Is AIG deserving a new bailout should they need more money. They've had a couple rounds of them so far. But, Chris, what was also released over the weekend was not only the positions of these executives who were getting the bonuses, but companies really around the world that were getting money from AIG after they received the bailout money. So the way it works is that investments that companies and states and municipalities in some cases had in AIG, when those investments turned sour, AIG didn't have the money to repay those investments with. That's when they turned to the federal government, and that's when the government did the bailouts in the fall and even this winter still. So, there, I mean, Goldman Sachs, Deutsche Bank, Merrill Lynch, the list goes on of these companies that AIG owed money to and could only repay them back once they received the federal bailout money. And that goes to show you just how big and intertwined AIG really is with all these companies worldwide. And remember, that was the reasoning behind giving AIG the bailout in the first place, with the thought that if they don't get the bailout money and if they fail on their investors, they'll bring down the whole system with them.
And so they've gone ahead and paid $165 million in executive bonuses. I don't know how well I don't know how they're successful.
The administration
will be. They say they're pursuing every legal avenue, but what the word is that these bonuses were written into contracts that were transacted months before the bailout. Yet, during the same time, that surely they must have known that things are heading south at a rapid rate.
And that's the question now. And Barney Frank, actually, he's the chair of the House Financial Services Committee. He's looking into this pretty carefully and seeing what of this executive bonus money is actually retractable. He's actually wondering, can not only AIG, but could the federal government say, we want those sums of the bonuses, we're going to retract our bailout money, we're going to take it back away from AIG so they can, you know, basically retract the bonuses, see if that's even legally possible. And that's what these lawmakers are going to want to do, because, like, you know, we've said, there's a lot of people who are outraged about this.
It comes to what the big insurer is planning on doling out, actually, is closer to $1 billion. The bonuses themselves are reported by the Associated Press to be $165 million. It's $1 billion, though, when you take into account what they call retention pay to employees. This has been the justification all along for paying these huge bonuses, that they needed to keep all of this amazingly intelligent, clever talent that they had. Well, it seems that this clever talent has managed to dig the company into the deepest hole the world's ever seen.
It's the talent that was, you know, the mortgage-backed securities. You know, remember that term from the fall, where all of this started from, those bad assets, those terms that were kind of coined that we didn't know anything about before last fall. These are the managers who are making those bad decisions, who are investing in those shaky areas of the mortgages, and depending on that murky area of investing to hold AIG afloat, which, as we know, did not turn out well at all.
If they got, there was a cartoon in the New Yorker to the effect that if these people got any more talented, we'd really be in trouble. Laura Summers says the Obama administration's priority is safeguarding the U.S. taxpayer, and people just are not buying that argument, at least not on the, you know, so-called Main Street. Wall Street, though, seems to be responding fairly well.
Yeah, well, I mean, for the past few days, Wall Street has been looking up, and it's a mixed bag here of feelings, because on one side, you have, AIG, you know, it's able to stay afloat, it's able to help these other companies, but then, of course, they're going to keep paying their employees and their executives. So what do you want? Do you want the company to remain in existence, or do you want the executives to get paid, or do you want them not to get paid? It's kind of, you can't pick and choose here. You know, if you're going to give the company the money, they're going to do with it what they want, and in most cases, it's, you know, paying their executives the six-figure salaries.
And on that note, thank you so much, Spencer Raymond. That, of course, is KBOO Spencer Raymond, joining us as he does every weekday morning by phone. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Chris.
This has been Headlines and Commentary from Air Cascadia for Monday, March 16th, 2009. Today's editor is Chris Andre. Engineering is Tammy Dean. The KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director is Kathleen Stevenson. I'm Liam Delta.
And I'm Chris Andre. You're listening to member-supported KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM. Your support and your support only keeps us subverting the dominant paradigm. Thank you so much, members.
Coming up next, If You Love This Planet, Dr. Helen Caldicott talks to Dr. Oliver Fine, president of Physicians for a National Healthcare Program. He'll outline their proposal for a single-payer system in the U.S.
Thanks for listening and have a good day.
Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Welcome to If You Love This Planet. Today we're discussing healthcare in the United States, and my guest is Dr. Oliver Fine, Professor of Clinical Medicine and Clinical Public Health and Associate Dean at the Weill Cornell Medical College in New York City. Dr. Fine is also President of Physicians for a National Health Program, PNHP, and immediate past President for the United States of the American Public Health Association. He also is a fellow of the American College of Physicians and serves on the Health Policy Committee of the Society of General Internal Medicine. He's also on the editorial board of the journal Medical Care. His recent writings include a chapter with Joanne Landy on the feasibility of fundamental health reform in the new book 10 Excellent Reasons for National Health Care, published in 2008. Dr. Oliver Fine, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. I'm delighted to be with you.
So how long have you been practicing medicine in the United States, Dr. Fine?
That's probably about 30, almost 34 years.
And tell me what you feel is the state of medical care, particularly in your practice. Let's go from your practice to the general public. How does it operate within your practice with insurance policies and the like and the like and hospital admissions? How does it operate now?
Well, I think major problem that many of my patients face are the increasing amounts of what are called co-pays and deductibles. That means that even though they may have some form of health insurance, that they have to lay out of pocket money before that health insurance goes into effect, or that they may have to pay an additional amount of money for every visit that they do and every test that they take and every medication that they purchase. And that leads to some major expenditures for people. People who are insured in the United States, many of them are underinsured, but they don't really realize it until they try to use their insurance.
Can you talk about the cost of drugs to these patients and how they cope?
Yeah, again, it's extremely variable. One example that is very interesting is, of course, the example of our Medicare program for people over 65. And the Republicans forced through a prescription drug benefit that unfortunately has what we call a donut hole in the middle of the benefit. That is to say, after a patient has paid about $2,500 for medications, then they are no longer insured until they pay up to $5,200.
Why on earth did the Republicans push that through? Was it to save money in the federal budget, or was it...
President Bush had just, you know, given tax relief, tax cuts to the wealthy, so that he would had to put through a program that, you know, because they didn't want to increase taxes, you know, might in fact appear not to do that. And so that's why the donut hole was there. But this also fit a certain ideology of what people, you know, call, we've got to make patients cost conscious.
Why? Well, I mean...
Well, so that they know what a medication costs. And this way, they won't go out and use them frivolously.
Does insurance then, Dr. Fine, pay for drugs as well?
Well, it depends, again, on the insurance that you have. And, you know, the Medicare program up until 2003 didn't pay, interestingly, for medication.
Yeah.
But now they do pay for medication, but you can only get the coverage through a private insurance company. And in New York State, there are 50 different private insurance companies that cover prescription drugs. And what Medicare, as a purchaser, is not allowed to do is to negotiate directly with the pharmaceutical industry. And so what you have are inflated prices because the larger purchaser would be Medicare, but it can't directly bargain to bring prices down.
Well, who said they can't bargain? Is that a law passed by Congress?
That's part of the law. All the Medicare, you know, prescription drug benefit has to go through a private insurance company. I think that there is increasingly a feeling among the population that this isn't really fair, and that this does need to be changed.
Well, and Dr. Fine, I'm interviewing Dr. Fine, who's a professor of clinical medicine and public health associate dean at the Cornell Medical College. Dr. Fine, let's go right back to the beginning. How did this sort of nefarious process of insurance arise? When? What date? And before that, what happened to medical care in the United States?
Yeah, right. Well, I think that there are, you know, four periods of health insurance, you know, reform in the United States. There's the period before 1936 where really people just didn't have any formal health insurance. People paid for their care out of pocket. They bartered for care, brought a chicken to the doctor, an apple pie. And what changed and brought in the second period, which I say goes about 1936 to 1965, was the creation of an entity called Blue Cross. Blue Cross was a private insurance company, but it was nonprofit, and it only covered hospital care at that time. But it gave a vehicle through which unions began to bargain for fringe benefits. Then during World War II is what I call the accident of history, that health insurance gets linked to employment in the United States. Unions were not allowed to bargain, you know, for wages, but they were able to bargain for fringe benefits, and health care was one of those fringe benefits. And then the Internal Revenue Service, our taxing entity, came along and it said if the employer contributes something to pay for premiums for health insurance, the employer can deduct that from their taxes.
And this is
what firmly married health insurance to employment in the United States. So we are, I think, the only industrialized nation where when you lose your job, you lose your health insurance.
Which is particularly scarifying now, right?
That's right, particularly when you have 14,000 jobs being lost every day. So 14,000 people losing their health insurance as well on a daily basis. So that's, you know, the period that I call employment-based health insurance. And then in 1965, what we began to see was a limited form of government health insurance. Medicare limited to people over 65. Medicaid limited to people with very low incomes, the poor. And the employment-based system, you know, persisted. And then in the late 1990s, we began to see really the rise of market-based health insurance. Nonprofit health insurers like Blue Cross converted to for-profit companies. And what you began to see was this, you know, competition among private health insurers to try to get rid of anybody who was sick. I mean,
how do you mean get rid of anyone
insure,
who was sick?
And only insure the healthy. The only way to get around that is, of course, to be employed by an employer who offers, you know, health insurance as a fringe benefit. But many, many employers during the 1990s and since 2000 have stopped, you know, offering health insurance. And that throws the individual into this individual market where the, you know, health insurance company can deny you a benefit if you've had a pre-existing condition, high blood pressure, cancer, diabetes. And this is their way of avoiding covering a sick person.
Well, that's wicked.
It is truly wicked. You're absolutely right. But that's where we are today. And it's one of the reasons why we in Physicians for a National Health Program really say we've got to move from this private health insurance-based system to what we call a one-payer or single-payer system that is run through usually government.
Okay, how many in total are there of these health insurance companies?
Well, it's estimated that there are probably about 1,500 private health insurance companies throughout the United States.
Tell me about the influence they have in Congress.
Well, a substantial influence, right, which is one of the big problems. They are major contributors, to many Congress people, both Democrats and Republicans, frankly. If you saw the movie Michael Moore made called Sicko, he actually outlines some of those political contributions to our Congress people.
Yeah. How much does the United States now spend on health care and drugs per capita?
Per capita, it is now over $7,000 per person.
Per year?
Per year.
Well, why is the American healthcare system so much more expensive when it's really rotten at its core in a way?
Yeah, well, partly that has to do with the fact that when you have all of these different insurance entities, it costs a great deal. They have high administrative costs and high profits. We calculate that about a 30% of all healthcare dollars in the United States are spent on administrative expenditure.
Oh, my God.
And, you know, there has to be some administrative expenditure, but we could cut that in half down to 15%.
30%.
If we went to a single payer or, you know, publicly financed healthcare system, a one payer system.
Why do you, I don't understand, we call it nationalized health here, and I think most Western countries do. Why do you call it single payer? I don't understand that term.
Well, because it, you know, simply means that rather than having multiple private health insurance payers,
yeah,
you're able to cut that down to a single payer.
Oh, it refers to who pays for the health care.
That's correct.
Not
who
the
pays
individual.
For it. It's not who delivers it, because the delivery system stays the same as it presently is.
Right.
You know, we do have a program that resembles single payer, and that's our Medicare program for the elderly.
Which works really well, right?
Which is fairly popular. It has its problems. It needs to be improved in many ways.
Mm.
You know, it certainly needs to be expanded to other ages in the population. But it's a pretty good program.
And how much does that cost per capita?
Well, it's also probably more than about $7,000 per capita, because, you know, what is the sickest segment of your population?
The old ones.
Yeah.
Like me.
And who else does Medicare cover? Under 65, people who are disabled permanently.
Yes.
And people who are on renal dialysis.
Oh, yes.
So the most expensive, you know, categories of patients are in the Medicare program, and therefore its costs are still above the per capita cost for the entire population.
Well, now, Dr. Fine, and I just would like to repeat that Dr. Fine is the president of Physicians for a National Health Program in the United States. Tell me how many of our colleagues would support this program. Is there a lot of passion around it within the medical profession?
Well, there's a growing passion. I will say that PNHP has, at this point, 15,000 members. That means that people are actually joining and, you know, paying dues and so forth. And that's a small segment of the physician population in the United States. But if you go out and you do a survey of physicians and you ask them, do you favor government involvement in the financing of the healthcare system, you find that really 59% of all physicians, practicing physicians in the United States, respond positively and say, yes, they do think that the only way is to have government involved. Mm. Now, it's not quite the same as saying that they favor a one-payer or a single-payer system, but that they actually see the importance of government involvement in the financing of healthcare.
Well, many of them must be pleased with the way Medicare functions. I mean, it's pretty smooth, isn't it?
There's, again, a wide variety of opinions about that. In some parts of the United States, Medicare doesn't pay as well as some of the commercial or private insurance companies in terms of, you know, what you would get for a visit to the doctor or what you would get to do an operation. And so some doctors have complained about Medicare not paying as much as some of the private insurers. On the other hand, the hassle is much less with Medicare. So I have been, for instance, in San Antonio, Texas, in the last year, and a cardiologist came up to me and said, you know, I have decided these private insurance companies keep denying my patients care. They won't let me get cardiac catheterizations on them when I think it's necessary. I'm going to go and restrict my practice to Medicare patients only.
Yeah.
So there are some doctors who do feel that the hassles are less, and that that's worth, you know, getting a little bit less in terms of their fees than they get from the private insurance.
I know when I was practicing and my colleagues were in the States, you have to ring the insurance company in the middle of the night to ask if you can do thus and thus or form this procedure on a patient. You get a little girl at a switchboard looking at a computer. You know, it's so demeaning, demoralizing. I mean, we spend how many years training to become expert internists, for instance, and we've got these insurance companies telling us what we can and can't do to our patients, right?
Yeah, well, and it's quite clear that there is more bureaucratic hassle, denying of care and so forth in the United States than there is, again, I think, in virtually any other industrialized country.
And then I see little old ladies, you know, at a desk in maybe your hospital or wherever, and they've got a multitude of forms from this insurance company and that one, and they're all confused, they don't know what's going on. You know, it's a nightmare just bureaucratically and for these poor patients.
Absolutely. That's why we say going to, you know, a single payer or one payer system would save our us about 15%. You know, we did a comparison of, you know, a hospital in Toronto General with the Massachusetts General in Boston.
Yeah.
Toronto General has about three billers, you know, in their administrative structure. The Mass General has over 300 billers.
What do you mean by biller?
Somebody who's processing billings and claims, dealing with the denial of claims, sending them to all. See, every insurance company has a different form, a different procedure, you know, what they will cover, what they won't cover, which diagnoses they cover, and so forth. And you need staff to fill all that stuff out in order to get paid.
The other thing I want to bring up is our profession. I mean, we are, in fact, an incredibly privileged sector of society. And I have thought about this pretty deeply. And I think, in fact, that teachers have a much greater responsibility towards society in general than do doctors. And I think that we are overpaid. Would you go along with that, Dr. Fine?
Well, what I would say is that, yes, I think today many students come into medical school with quite a bit of idealism.
Yeah.
The notion of being in a profession that provides service, being able to help people is very important. But what happens to many students in the United States today is that they end up with an enormous debt.
Mm.
Before they graduate.
How much is
the average debt from a private medical school in the United States is about $150,000 to $160,000. And so I think this shapes career choices. That students then decide to go into the more lucrative side of medicine in order to be able to pay back some of the debts that they have acquired. So that's one part of, you know, what's going on, frankly. But I still think that many people go into medicine, you know, frankly, because they want to help people.
Yeah. Well, you know, in Australia, when I did medicine, it was totally free. If you got certain grades at the end of school, you got a Commonwealth scholarship, and the whole of our medical school education was free. If we were poor, relatively, we got a living allowance, a book allowance. So we graduated with no debt. And that's the way it should be.
I think that's the way it should be.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's something that we would like to see happen again and think would be more possible, you know, under a single payer, you know.
So the single payer, to get this straight again, the single payer is the government.
Yes, that would be our notion, is that it would be...
Well, why don't you then be more direct and call it nationalized medicine? Like, you know, the Pentagon's nationalized, let's be frank, and they spend about $1 trillion of taxpayers' money a year.
I think the reason we don't do that is that there is, you know, a little bit of a bias in the United States against nationalizing anything.
Except for the Pentagon.
You're hearing it right today around the issue of nationalizing some of the big banks.
I know. It's pathetic.
President Obama doesn't use the word nationalize. He keeps away from that. The other thing that's very different from the Pentagon is that the Pentagon not only, uses tax money, but it employs, it's the government employing generals and soldiers and so on, we're not talking about the government employing, you know, doctors.
No.
We're actually talking about doctors remaining independent, negotiating their fees with government. Hospitals would not be owned by government in our proposal. They would continue to be run by local boards of trustees so that they respond to the local needs of the community in which they're located. So it is a little different. It really isn't like the National Health Service in the UK, where doctors are employed by government and where hospitals are owned by government. That's what I call truly socialized or nationalized medicine.
Yes. Well, in Australia, the doctors are not employed by the government, but, you know, I would go and see a doctor, and then I pay my bill and walk next door to the Medicare office, and the money's handed back to me by the government in my hand, the cash. So the doctors are free and independent. There are some private hospitals, but the public hospitals are paid for by the state governments, actually. But they have their own boards. They're free to make their own decisions. So, you know, you don't have to think that the whole thing will be taken over. I think it would be good to look at that system, because ours works pretty well here, although I have to say I think many of the specialists, per se, like radiologists and dermatologists and the like, make too much money. And I think the people on the coalface of medicine, like family practitioners, general practitioners, they actually should be equally as well paid as the specialists.
Yeah,
would you agree with that?
I do agree with that, being a general internist. And I think that is a major problem here in the United States today, is that we are probably down to about one-third of all doctors in the country being primary care doctors.
Oh.
And two-thirds are specialists.
Yeah.
And that balance is just not good, I think, for patients or for the profession. And certainly one reason that this has developed is that there is you could call it overpayment of the specialist group of physicians, and certainly an underpayment of the primary care.
Yeah, well, that needs to be fixed too. So let's move on to the main issue then at hand. You've got this question here: who favours single payer and who fights against single payer? We should address that first.
Okay, well, you know, the interesting thing is when you do a poll, and the poll doesn't necessarily use the term single payer, but it says, you know, to the public, would you prefer the current system or a system like Medicare, that program for the elderly, run by government and financed by taxpayers? The answer is that anywhere is from 62 to 68% of Americans favor that kind of a system. Now, it may not be called single payer, but it certainly means that the public in general, I think, has a sympathy for this direction. Then if you go on and, you know, you look at business, okay, business is more ambivalent, although I think an increasing number of people in business are favoring moving toward a more single-payer, government-run and finance system.
Egalitarian.
Yeah, right. And it's, you know, there is a poll in CFO magazine, that's Chief Financial Officer magazine, and what you see is that about 43% of chief financial officers favor that kind of system.
Yeah.
If we go to, you know, the faith community, for instance, the churches, in the last year, what we have found is that the Presbyterian Church, the Unitarian Church, their General Assemblies have favored single-payer national health insurance.
Interesting.
And then if you go to unions, there's again a little bit of a division among unions, but an increasing number of local unions are beginning to favor this. If we look at the Central Labor Council's local union groups and look at their support for the one bill in Congress called H.R. 676, that is a single-payer bill, you're finding that over 450 local union groups are supporting that. And then just this past year, in June, the Council of Mayors of Cities in the United States was meeting in Florida, and they also came out in support of H.R. 676, House of Representatives Bill 676.
Okay, now, who's opposed?
So, who's opposed? Well, quite clearly the private health insurance industry. Okay, very potent. We talked about that before because they can contribute substantial amounts to political candidates.
Yep.
And the other group that seems quite opposed is the pharmaceutical industry.
Oh, of course.
And they're the ones that really engineered this situation with Medicare that doesn't allow the Medicare program to bargain directly with the pharmaceutical industry, because if they did, the Medicare program would be able, I think, to bring drug prices down. In fact, I don't know if you know, but the entity in the United States that gets the lowest drug prices, can you guess what that would be?
No.
It's the Veterans Administration.
Oh.
Because they, in fact, have a large purchasing pool, so to speak.
Yep, yep.
And they're able to bargain for the lowest prices.
But I have to say, too, those drug companies, you've got a wicked... I've recounted this before. I interviewed Marcia Angel recently, who was the former editor of the New England Journal, and she's written a wonderful book on these drug companies. But I just want to recount a personal anecdote. I went to a CVS pharmacy recently to get about 20 sleeping pills, temazepam, for my jet lag.
Ah.
And I went to the counter and they said, that'll be $93. I said, what? And I said, I'd rather stay awake all night than pay for that. And I marched out of the shop and they said, well, you're lucky you got it cheaply. You're a doctor. I mean,
I would
pay about $5, and it would cost a pharmaceutical company just a few cents to produce 20 of those, if that.
Yeah.
I mean, this thing is absolutely obscene.
It is truly obscene.
Okay, so what are we going to do about it? I'll help you.
We have a lot of education to do.
Yes.
But I think that we need to be firm advocates for what we call a single payer. What we mean by that is a publicly funded
medical
national
system.
Health insurance program in the United States.
And drugs.
Which would include drugs, which would include long-term care, nursing home care, and home care for people.
Hospitals.
Would include hospitals, doctors, preventive care, dental care.
Yes.
And mental health care.
And eyes.
A comprehensive set of benefits.
Yes.
Right? And I would say that should be available to the entire population of the United States. We would say available to all residents in the United States. And you could define residency then as, you know, people who had lived here 3 months or 6 months or 9 months. This way we would deal with the difficult problem of immigration problems that we have in the United States. Because I believe we should also cover people who are immigrants.
Obviously we should cover everyone. That's what our profession is.
Right. And there ought to be what we call automatic enrollment. So someone presents to the emergency room. They haven't gotten any kind of health insurance. Well, we just enrolled them right there.
Of course.
Someone's admitted to the hospital and they don't have any kind of insurance. Well, we just enrolled them there. Is there any private health insurance company that would enroll you when you were in the emergency room?
Mm-hmm.
Or when you were admitted to the hospital? No. And that's, again, one of the fundamental principles of a single-payer program is automatic enrollment.
Absolutely.
Comprehensive benefits. And, you know, essentially low administrative costs. We didn't talk about the exact numbers before, but Medicare, our one single-payer program in the United States, has an administrative cost of 3%. Means that 97% of all dollars go to pay for doctors, hospitals, medication, so forth, through taxing.
Compared with?
Compared with private health insurance, which on the average has a 20% administrative cost and profit.
3% to 20%.
Right, so only 80% of all premium dollars collected by private insurers go to pay for doctors, hospitals, and medication.
When I wrote my book, If You Love This Planet, in 92, I came upon an anecdote which occurred. You know, patients could not be admitted to a hospital because they were not adequately insured. And, you know, a guy who was terribly burnt died in the hospital parking lot of his burns. And someone else died of diabetic coma in the hospital parking lot. I mean, it's like a third world country. And,
yeah.
the other point to make is that we now cover patients seeing psychologists, too, so their mental health is now covered as well.
Oh, well, that's great. I mean, that's been a strong movement in this country, is to get what we call mental health parity with physical health.
Yes.
That the reimbursement would really be similar, and in
yes.
the past, there was a real discrimination against people who had mental health problems.
Which all of us do have at some stage or other in our lives.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Depending on our grief and all sorts of things. Now, one last question. Tell us what you think the President, President Obama, is going to do about this whole situation, Dr. Fine.
We just had his speech before Congress last night, in which he said that health care reform was really still very much on the top of his agenda. And we think that's important that he's thinking that way because, you know, there have been some problems with the resignation of Senator Daschle.
Mm-hmm.
And we all worried that that would set back the reform agenda.
Mm.
But it looks like he's going to push ahead on that,
yes.
which is good. The question is, you know, what will he push ahead on? And
yes.
regrettably, although in the past he was an advocate of single payer, he has essentially said that he would sign a law that had single payer, but I don't think he'll be the advocate for it. He views it as being too, I guess, partisan. And, you know, frankly, this past period has shown that even though he's tried to be quite bipartisan, bring in both Republicans and Democrats, he's been pretty unsuccessful with our stimulus package in doing that. So I regret that he's not actually pushing single payer, but that is where I think he stands at this point.
Do you think the health insurance companies got to him?
Well, I think
did
that
he
they're,
receive
deeply,
money from
they're deeply, involved with all these issues. I'm not sure I would say they literally got to him. But
yeah.
I think that what he is seeing is that the Republicans are going to be very strong defenders of the private health insurance industry.
Those Republicans are so out to lunch.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Now, one of the options that is going to be talked about is what's called a public option, that in the employer market, that people should be able to buy into, you know, a Medicare-like public program.
Yes.
And if its administrative costs remain at 4%, it might be able to be offered cheaper than private health insurance, which has that 20%
yes.
administrative cost.
Yes.
We're very interested in that alternative, but a little bit worried about it because we know how good the private health insurance industry is at, again, risk selection, avoiding
yeah.
the sick and only covering the healthy.
Obscene.
One way they do this, interestingly, you might find this fascinating, they
yeah.
do this by offering a free health club membership. The private health insurance companies have done that. And I thought initially, well, that's great because I'd like my patients to do more exercise
yeah.
and be involved with a health club. But then I thought about my sickest patient.
They can't go.
Mrs. Smith, who has congestive heart failure, she can't go.
No,
right?
No.
Mrs. Jones, who's got crippling arthritis.
Yes.
This is not going to be attractive to them. And so it leaves
yeah.
the really sick people in the public program.
It's a selection.
And then what will happen is the public program will cost more and more per patient. The private health insurance companies will cost less and less.
Yeah.
And there'll be this very unfair competition between the two entities.
So, Dr. Fine, do you think most Democrats in Congress support your plan and the Republicans, obviously, for ideological and stupid reasons, oppose it? Is that generally how
well,
it would settle down?
Well, it's much more complicated than that because many of the Democrats are, you know, supporting programs that are not single-payer. We, in the last Congress, for this bill, H.R. 676,
yeah.
we had about 92 co-sponsors
yeah.
in the House.
Yeah.
Now, our House of Representatives has about 435
yeah.
members.
Not enough.
So, not enough. That's right. And when you have a president who may not fully support this direction
yep.
at this time,
yep.
There are more Democrats that are wary about it. We have now, you know, each time you get a new Congress, you have to go back to get your co-sponsors. We've got over 50 co-sponsors right now for H.R. 676.
Okay.
So that's good, but it's not quite enough.
Do you yeah. have a web page that people can go to? And if there are any physicians listening to this program, I encourage you all to join. So what is your web page?
The web page is P N as in Nelly H P P N H P
dot
O R G.
Okay. So,
and you, by the way, don't have to be a physician to join us.
Okay.
So we have lower rates for people who are not physicians, and it's a great source. P N H P. Dot O R G.
Well, I thank you very much for such an edifying, lucid discussion of healthcare in the United States. I wish you all the best of luck. And it's really just following the Hippocratic Oath, is it not?
That's absolutely correct.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Dr. Fine.
All the best. Stay well.
You too. My guest on If You Love This Planet today was Dr. Oliver Fine, Professor of Clinical Medicine and Clinical Public Health at the Weill Cornell Medical College in York City. Dr. Fine is also president of Physicians for National Health Program, and you can find them on pnhp.org. pnhp.org. Thank you for listening, and we'll talk together next week.
And thank you, Helen. That was If You Love This Planet, Dr. Helen Caldicott, the host. Next up, we have Health Watch. Your host, Dr. David Naiman, interviews Dr. Cheryl Tilner, naturopathic physician, also author of Herbal Medicine from the Heart of the Earth. And at 11:30, we'll hear a talk by Amory Lovins of the Rocky Mountain Institute on energy efficiency.
Stay tuned for Health Watch after a couple of announcements.
This KABU program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Portland Counseling Center, working with your emotional intelligence on relationships, parenthood, divorce, conflict, stress, and more. Portland Counseling Center works with individuals, couples, families, and teens. Information and appointments at 503-295-6265 or portland-counseling.com.
And the program has also been made possible in part by Common Ground Wellness Center and Inner City Hot Tubs, a community wellness center committed to integrative healing through hot tub and sauna, massage, acupuncture, naturopathy, counseling, and more. Now open at its new location at Northeast 33rd in Alberta. Information at 503-238-1065 or soakandsauna.com. The purpose of this program is not to prescribe a treatment to individuals. Listeners should consult their healthcare practitioner before attempting any treatment.
Good morning and welcome to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host. Today's guest is Dr. Cheryl Tilner. Dr. Tilner is a naturopathic physician, an herbalist, the founder of Wise Woman Herbals, and currently the owner and operator of Wise Acres Farm, where she hosts the Northwest Herb Fest and the Sustainable Lifestyles Festival. Dr. Tilner is here today to talk about the second edition of her book, Herbal Medicine from the Heart of the Earth. If you'd like to join the conversation with Dr. Tilner, the number here at the studio is 503-231-8187. Welcome to Health Watch, Cheryl.
Good morning, Dr. Naiman. I'm delighted to be here in KABU with you.
Well, let's start out acquainting our listeners with your book, Herbal Medicine. Who is this book for, and what inspired you to write it?
This book came about because I seem to be getting the same questions over and over. When I owned Wise Woman Herbals, I spent a lot of time answering questions on the phone, and I realized at one point that the information that I was giving to people wasn't listed anywhere in a book that I could just sue. And so I started writing out what became a pamphlet initially, and never actually got produced as a pamphlet because I just kept writing on it for 5 years. I couldn't seem to stop. And finally, one day I realized I had an entire book and I'd better get off the computer and actually publish it. I did that 10 years ago, and then recently I put out a new updated second version. And I think in reality I could have volumes, but at some point you have to stop yourself.
Well, let's acquaint our listeners a little bit about your approach to herbs in general. I know there's a division in the natural medicine community around how to use herbs, and some people go towards standardized extracts of active constituents, and other people vie away from that for philosophical and other reasons. And I was curious where you fall on that, and maybe you could share a little bit of your philosophy about herbal medicine.
I would say probably somewhere in between. I don't usually use standardized products. However, there are some, for instance, ginkgo biloba, which is standardized to ginkgo lides. That particular product does not have a Western history behind it. It is the research that was done on the standardized product that mostly people are using as their basis for herbal medicine use of ginkgo here in the West. There is Chinese usage, but not of the leaves, which is what we use here. And so historically, there really isn't any information you can use. It's just the research on the ginkgo lides. So in that case, I say, you know, first you should use the standardized product, then try the non-standardized product, which was never used in that way historically, to see if you get the same results. It turns out that people do get similar results with it. Some of the things that it gets used for, say, such as kidney failure, I continue to use the standardized product for people with kidney failure, and I just don't want to try testing the non-standardized product. But with most herbs, I feel like the standardized product is totally unnecessary.
Do you see the use of standardized extracts as part of a movement to use herbs more like drugs versus the way they were traditionally used?
In a way, because what you're doing in some cases is simply standardizing to those constituents, and the manufacturer is throwing away the other constituents in the plant. Now, some companies are standardizing to a particular constituent or set of constituents, and they're putting that back in the base of the herb. When they do that, you still have the full spectrum of the original herb, and so that's a much better route to go. I definitely tell people to usually stay away from standardized products that only have a constituent or a group of constituents in them.
And what are your feelings about the substances known or unknown in herbs that are part of the whole herb product versus the standardized product?
Well, there's a couple things there. First, we don't know all the constituents that are in the plants. There is a ton of research on many plants, but in reality, we just know a handful of constituents in each of the plants. But then additionally, when you standardize a product, chemicals are generally used to extract that product. So not only are you getting the constituents of the plant extracted, but you still have a certain amount of the chemical left in that product. There was some research done on that by Paul Bergner, who writes Medical Herbalism, quite a few years back, where he went and put all the research together looking at the information on chemicals that are used to extract the plants, and found that quite a bit of chemicals was actually left in those finalized products.
And with your book, Herbal Medicine, when you decide what herbs to use and what information about the herbs, how do you decide how to prioritize information? I know that we have traditions, either native traditions or European traditions, of how herbs have been used over the generations, and then we have more recently studies of varying quality on herbs. Is your book a synthesis of all of these things, or do you place a stronger emphasis on certain knowledge versus others?
It's definitely a mix. I start out usually with tradition, because tradition, it's really hard to go wrong. It's been tried and true. You know what's going to happen. Then next, I look at research, modern research. Unfortunately, sometimes research doesn't see the whole picture. It's looking at something very specific, and when you do that, you sometimes make mistakes. But I find the research can be very useful. You may have 20 different ways to use a single herb. Research will come up with a brand new one that you never even thought of, and perhaps people used it that way in the past, but we just don't know about it anymore. So the research can be very useful. And additionally, the research often backs up what has been historically already known. So for people who are more scientifically oriented and are not interested in, you know, the tried and true version of use of the herb, they can look at the research and get involved with herbalism where they might not have otherwise.
Well, let's take our first caller. Welcome to Health Watch. You're on the air with Dr. Tilner.
Yes, Dr. Tilman, haven't we in the United States been systematically and deliberately cut off from using herbs in our daily lives generations ago because of industrialization and other things happening? And isn't it impractical, for low-income and like people today to use herbs because of the scarcity and the expensive aspects of it? I'll listen to your what you have to say.
Thank you for the call.
It depends on how the person is actually using their herbs, because herbs are very inexpensive to actually use, but the problem is that a lot of people don't grow things anymore. If the person grows their own things, and even you can even grow things in a window box, on a veranda, that most cities now have plots of land, various plots of land throughout cities where people can grow garden areas. And if you grow and process your own plant material, it's very inexpensive to do. And that's what I'm really devoting my time to, is helping people learn how to do that, because people really need to take back healthcare into their own hands, learn how their bodies work, learn how they can use simple herbs to keep themselves healthy, and then also to use those if they're ailing in some way. So herbalism really can be the low-income or poor person's herb. I think of it as, you know, the earth-oriented poor person's way for health.
Well, I know, and it makes me think of Cuba, because with the embargo in Cuba and the fall of the Soviet Union, they were having a lot of trouble getting pharmaceutical medications, and they started a whole program there of educating people from kindergarten up on how to grow and identify herbs in their communities. And that's obviously not a country that's got that is rich in capital, so I would imagine if we could share that information, it could actually be something that would benefit low and middle income people more.
Definitely, and I think that there are more and more people available to teach about herbalism. When I first wanted to learn, I couldn't find anybody. It was really hard in the beginning. There was not much of an interest. The interest has really peaked now. There are a lot of herbalists around, much more than there used to be. So most cities have a variety of people who are available teaching classes, whether giving herb walks in parks or teaching classes out of their homes or in a local college. You can find herbalists in various places that will teach you.
And we should mention that your book, Herbal Medicine, has a pretty extensive section on how to harvest and store and prepare herbs in different forms.
There's a very detailed section on preparing tinctures, salves, herbal oils, elixirs, just all the main types of herbal preparations that people would use. And there are pictures also to help people to get a little bit more of an idea of how to do it.
And I would imagine that different herbs are going to be more effective in different forms?
Certainly. Some herbs are better to use fresh. Some are better to use dry, although there are not too many that you have to use dry. Things like cascara bark, you would not want to use that fresh. That has to be aged for a whole year. But often, most of the herbs can be used dry. There's maybe a handful or more that you have to use fresh to really get good results from them.
And if we have listeners whose interests are piqued today about starting for the first time with herb preparation or growing, maybe to start a little herbal medicine cabinet at home, where would you have them start? Is there an herb that, or herbs that you would recommend, or a preparation technique you'd recommend?
Well, I would say if we start with the basics here, I'd say if you're growing it, calendula is one of the easiest things to grow, and it has a lot of uses. There are a lot of different herbs that are very easy to grow, but that is the easiest one. It's almost hard not, you just can't go wrong with it. You put the seed in the soil, it's going to grow, and then it reseeds itself. And calendula is a really nice first aid item. Usually you make it into a really strong tincture to use it. However, you can also make a tea out of it. Probably if you're purchasing herbs as opposed to growing them, I would say that you, again, could buy the calendula in the store. Probably the most used herb would be echinacea. And the species of echinacea, people ask, should I use echinacea angustifolia or should I use echinacea purpurea? Really, they're both good. I find echinacea angustifolia has a longer shelf life. But if they're both fairly fresh, and by fairly fresh I mean they're not more than a year old, that you're going to get good results from either of them. They make a nice tea. You can use them as a tincture. And mostly orally, although echinacea also gets used externally on the skin for various things, as if you have some sort of septic kind of condition in the skin, or if you have, say, a brown recluse spider bite. So, but mostly people take it orally, and they're taking it to help keep from getting a cold or the flu, or to help decrease the amount of time that they have an infectious condition.
Is echinacea an example of an herbal use that's relatively recent in terms of cold prevention? I was, in the stuff that I've read about it in terms of its traditional uses, it seemed like it was more of an herb used for boils and maybe throat conditions, but not so much for preventative medicine. And is that true, or
it traditionally has been traditionally was used by the Native Americans, and that's where we learned today to use it. Prior to that, you won't see it being used in Europe. Prior to that, it was the Native Americans that taught the settlers to use it, and then it went back to Europe. A lot of our herbal medicine either comes from European background, and it even has more ancient roots than that, but more recently from European background, or from information that the Native Americans gave to people when the settlers came in. And echinacea did get used for more sepsis-type situations. It also got used for rattlesnake bite. And it actually has good reason for being used for rattlesnake bite, and although it's not probably what I would suggest first for people, if I was in the mountains and got bit by a rattlesnake, I would, and I had echinacea with me or near me, I would be putting it in my wound really fast.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Dr. Cheryl Tilner, the author of Herbal Medicine from the Heart of the Earth. If you'd like to join the conversation or ask any questions for Dr. Tilner, the number is 503-231-8187. One of the things that I think that a lot of people get scared off of herbs about is herbal side effects or herbal interactions with drugs. So you hear about this often on the news, and I wonder if the media is overplaying the state of herbal interactions. But I was curious what your take is on that and whether your book addresses that at all for people who may be on pharmaceutical medications and are concerned about taking herbs.
I definitely list them. Each herb has a section in it that lists all the contraindications that are known, and that includes any kind of interactions with drugs. The thing about herbal medicine that people need to remember, though, is for the most part, most herbs, and I'm not saying there are some herbs that we could consider to be in a toxic category, but most herbs are going to be so much more safe than taking a drug. And I'm sure with all the information in the media nowadays, or people having their own experiences, that they know how hazardous drugs can be. Herbs, in relation, are very safe. And all you have to do is look at the number of people that have side effects from herbs or have, you know, any kind of problems at all from herbs and compare that with drugs, and you immediately see that herbs are incredibly safe.
And so in terms of interactions between herbs and drugs, do you also share that information?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
So would people be able to find in your book, Herbal Medicine, information to share with their physicians who may be concerned about what they're taking?
Certainly. And there are, for instance, if the person was to St. John's wort is something that's been in the news. A lot of people have heard about using it for depression. And funny enough, depression is not the main way that St. John's wort really gets used. However, that's what people know about it. And that particular person or that particular herb, if they were to look it up, they would see that there can be interactions with a lot of herbs with St. John's wort. And the reason is how St. John's wort affects the enzyme system of the liver. And it causes some drugs to be taken out of the body faster, some of them to remain in the body longer. So that means that that drug now is going to have a different effect. Either it's going to be increased or decreased in the body. That can be problematic. And so it's just a matter of knowing that. And what I do if I'm working with someone is I simply monitor and keep them on the same dose of St. John's wort, never changing it, because that's where the problem comes up, is if the person suddenly adds St. John's wort while they're using a particular drug or takes it out or decreases the amount being taken, then it causes problems.
Again, we're talking to Dr. Cheryl Tilner, the author of Herbal Medicine. If you'd like to join the conversation on Health Watch, the number is 503-231-8187. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM. So what is the difference between, or what has been added, Cheryl, between the first and second edition?
Well, there are quite a few herbs added to it, I think about 20 or so. And then many of the herbs just have additional information in it. Most of the information is newer information that wasn't known 10 years ago. We talked about the fact that research has given us new avenues of use for various herbs, and so a lot of that has been added in there. Things that have, over the last 10 years, came out and seem to be working really well. I'm a little hesitant to add brand new research in that it hasn't really been tried much yet. So the information I put in, I like it to be something that people know that if they use that that's going to work for them.
And for listeners who may not have a natural bias or inclination towards using herbs, you mentioned that in general, they have far fewer side effects than pharmaceuticals.
Oh, yeah.
What are some other arguments you would make in herbs' favor as an approach towards dealing with health promotion and disease treatment?
Well, going back to the woman who called and was concerned about low-income people being able to afford herbs, in reality, they're much less expensive than drugs are. Drugs are, can be extremely expensive, and as we know, many people are not covered by health insurance, and even if they do have health care insurance, it may not cover their drugs, or it may only cover a percentage of them. Herbs are going to cost way less for them to use, whether they grow them themselves or whether they purchase them. And especially if people make teas, and teas can, they take longer to make than if they were to buy a tincture and just pop it in their mouth, or buy a pill and pop it in their mouth. But a tea can be very rewarding to make. It's a very relaxing thing, and in this day and age, people are so on the go, and they're wearing their adrenals out, and to take a moment to make a tea and to sit and drink it is a very healthy, good thing for us all to do.
Let's take another caller. Welcome to Health Watch. You're on the air with Dr. Tilner.
Hi, is it? Am I on the line?
You're on the line.
Hey, how you doing? I'm very interested in your conversation. Thank you for KBOO. Thank you for Dr. Scheller, Dr. Tilner, that is, and thank you for yourself, sir. I would really like to talk with her if she has a telephone number. It's a long, involved situation, but I have been passing kidney stones for the past 20 years after a back injury. And it just gets a little bit to be a little bit ridiculous. So I'm taking gravel root at this time, marshmallow root, and corn silk. But I would really, if, ma'am, if you have a telephone number that I could have a private consultation with you, I'd appreciate it. And I'll just take your answer offline, okay?
Thank you for the call.
Thank you.
At the end of the program, we'll share any contact information Dr. Tilner wants to give about getting the book and other resources that people can go to. In terms of the kidney stones, though, Dr. Tilner, I know your book also includes some naturopathic adjunct therapies along with the herbal medicine. Maybe you could share how that works in your book.
As far as kidney stones, it can depend on what. There's different herbs that will help with decreasing the chance to get a kidney stone. There are herbs that help decrease the spasms and pain that a person is feeling when they're passing a stone. So there's various things that you can look at. You can have both preventative and acute formulas that a person might want to actually use. And so you need to take a look at that. Overall, the person needs to drink a lot of water would be one of the adjunct things that they need to make sure they're doing. And I'm always shocked at how little amount of water that many people will actually drink. People also need to do just, you know, some general things that you would think would be common knowledge, but just urinating when they feel like they need to urinate rather than holding it in. So there's a lot of things that people can do. As far as herbs that are just helpful herbs that they can use in general to keep from getting kidney stones, dandelion leaf is a wonderful thing to use. Corn silk, parsley root, burdock, there's a variety of things, cleavers. These are all herbs people can think about in helping to keep from getting kidney stones.
And with various conditions, you also include some advice occasionally on hydrotherapy or vitamins and minerals. Is that right?
Oh, definitely. Certainly. Yeah, hydrotherapy can be extremely useful. And especially if a person is passing a kidney stone, what most people say when they're passing kidney stones is the thing that helps more than anything is heat. And a lot of people will actually stand in a hot shower with the shower directly over the area. And what that is doing is it's just allowing the area to relax. The heat is allowing the area to relax. Now, they can do that with hot cloths also. And once they're able to relax and they don't have as many spasms, then the stone can pass a little better. There's also herbs that are very helpful with that. Herbs like kella, kava, those herbs also help the ureter to relax so the stone can be passed. So there's various things that can be really helpful. One thing I would mention is the gentleman had mentioned using gravel root. And although gravel root is useful, gravel root also contains pyrrolizidine alkaloids. And gravel root is not something I would tell people to take long term. So that if he's taking that for a couple weeks, I wouldn't be concerned. But he really needs to be careful about taking it long term because pyrrolizidine alkaloids can cause what's called hepatovenoocclusive disease in the liver. And although there are very few cases, it appears, that can be directly attributed to herbs, it's something to be careful about.
That's a great tip. So do you also offer advice in the book? I know a lot of herbal books talk about the properties of individual herbs. Do you talk about how to combine herbs into formulas?
I actually have a section that gives a huge variety of herbal formulas. And it doesn't really tell people how to combine them themselves, but it gives all sorts of suggestions of formulas and then explains why those particular herbs are in the formula. Teaching people to create herbal formulas is pretty involved, and so generally I do that in a classroom situation because I find there are so many questions as you go along. It's kind of a complicated thing to learn. Generally, people first learn the individual herbs, something about them. They'll use formulas other people have created. And once they've done that, they've gotten their feet wet and they feel like they've gotten beyond the beginner stage. That's the time when they usually start wanting to put formulas together themselves.
Let's try to squeeze in one last call. Welcome to Health Watch. You're on the air with Dr. Tilner. And if you can keep your question brief, that would be great.
Yes. I'd like to ask, what would be a good herbs to be giving? I have a 9-year-old boy who is ADD.
The best thing I could do just as a general formula is there's a really nice formula in my book, and I'm looking to see what it's called here. Maybe I'm not going to find it that quickly, I guess. There it is. It's actually listed as antidepressive formula, but that same formula I found works really good with ADD kids. And the herbs that are in it are St. John's wort, oats, Siberian ginseng, skullcap, chamomile, schisandra. They're herbs that really help to nourish and support the nervous system. And they're calming type of herbs, but also they're going to feed the nervous system.
Thank you for the call. I would also imagine you might want to look into nutritional culprits as a possible additional thing.
Definitely, certainly. And even some of the suggestions that are in the book for just general nervous system information are very helpful.
Well, we're almost out of time. I was hoping you do you teach classes these days?
That's actually what my main focus is teaching other people how to take care of themselves. And we do that here at the farm. And people can see information on the classes or the festivals that we put on if they go to herbaltransitions.com on the website.
And do you still do consultations as a physician or mostly in a classroom setting?
Mostly in a classroom setting. I find that I have very long days and it's hard to see people anymore.
Could you tell us a little bit briefly about Wiseacres Farms?
Wiseacres Farm is a teaching farm, and we focus on herbs. We have huge herb gardens here, and that is definitely my main passion. But we also teach people other independent, what I call independent lifestyles. We teach people how to grow their own food, how to take care of small animals, how to make cheese, how to preserve their food. Things that I think are very handy for people to know, and especially now when people are realizing that they really have to take care of themselves. The government's not going to be there to take care of us. It's good to learn how to do a few of these things.
And the website again?
HerbalTransitions.com.
That's great. And they can learn about the farm there as well?
They certainly can.
Great. Well, it was great having you on Health Watch today, Dr. Tilner.
Thank you so much, Dr. Naiman.
So we are talking today with Dr. Cheryl Tilner, the author of Herbal Medicine from the Heart of the Earth. Stay tuned for the rest of the Monday Morning Radio Zine.
This KABU program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Organics to You, locally owned and operated and delivering local, organic, farm-direct produce to your door 52 weeks a year.
To design your personal delivery schedule, the number is 503-236-6496 or organicstoyou.org.
It's 11:30. You are tuned to KBOO, KBOO Radio, community radio here in Portland, Oregon. Our final feature of the Radio Zine for Monday, March 16th, is a talk by Amory Lovins of the Rocky Mountain Institute, speaking on energy efficiency.
There's Amory Lovins on energy efficiency. The crisis in the Persian Gulf has once again clearly demonstrated the urgency for the United States to be energy efficient. There are few in this country who are more knowledgeable on this subject than Amory Lovins. A distinguished physicist, he was awarded the 1989 Onassis Foundation Delphi Prize for environmental work. He's the author of numerous books and articles on energy use and conservation. I interviewed Amory Lovins at the Rocky Mountain Institute in Old Snow Mass, Colorado. You've said that electricity is the most costly form of energy and that it takes up about a quarter of all global development capital, and you contend that most of that could be saved.
Yes, we have technologies on the market today that can provide exactly the same services as now or better, using only about a quarter as much electricity as now. And quadrupling our efficiency of using electricity in that way would cost much less than we pay right now to operate coal and nuclear plants, even if building them costs nothing.
How would you deliver those technologies to the individual consumer, for example?
That depends on the society. In some parts of the United States, especially for low-income customers, utilities simply give away the technologies. Southern California Edison Company, for example, has given away over 600,000 quadruple efficiency light bulbs because it costs the utility less to do that than to operate its existing power stations to make the extra electricity which would otherwise be wasted in existing light bulbs. Utilities offer over half of Americans concessionary loans, that is, at low or no interest, for fixing up their house to be more efficient, or rebates for buying more efficient appliances. Some utilities are leasing equipment so that you have only a small payment each month instead of a big one up front. Utilities provide many kinds of information on how to use electricity in a way that saves money. And there's a very exciting new set of market-oriented implementation methods we've developed, which effectively make saved electricity into a commodity, just like copper, wheat, and sow bellies. For example, we've already had the first deal signed in which one utility pays another utility to save electricity and sell it back to the first one at a favorable price. And you can do the same thing between customers, so anybody can profit by going bounty hunting for inefficient uses of electricity and fixing them up. In 8 states, there's competitive bidding. So if a utility wants more electricity, it simply says to the world at large, who out there would like to make or save or displace electricity? At what price? We will take the low bids, which of course turn out to be savings. We have about a dozen utilities selling efficiency for fun and profit in the territories of other utilities. Puget Power, for example, sells electricity in one state, but efficiency in 7 states. We've even figured out neat ways for gas utilities to make money selling electric efficiency. And Massachusetts is thinking of introducing a law this year in which if you hook up a new building to the grid and it's inefficient, you pay a fee, and the worse the building, the bigger the fee. But if you hook up an efficient new building, the utility pays you to hook it up, and the more efficient the building, the bigger the rebate.
You've taken a very dim view of the nuclear power industry's efforts to capture the electricity market, as it were. Why is that?
Well, this industry has absorbed altogether about $1 trillion of public and private capital. It's delivering less energy than wood, and it's so uneconomic that if you've just built a reactor, it's cheaper to write it off and give away that much efficiency instead than to run the plant. I can't think of any other case where so much has been spent by so many for so little. And even if there weren't much cheaper options on the supply side, which there certainly are today, the things you can do on the customer side of the meter would certainly knock nuclear out of consideration on straightforward economic grounds. We can now save 4 times as much electricity as the nuclear plants make, at something like an eighth the cost of running them, even if building them were free. And it's not free. It's billions of dollars per plant. So I think that goes a long way toward explaining why this technology is dying of an incurable attack of market forces throughout the world's market economies, and why I feel that those who think it's such a great idea should put their own capital into it instead of continuing to try to put our money where their mouths are.
What are your views on solar energy?
Well, we're doing this interview in front of a building at 7,100 feet where it goes to minus 47 degrees on occasion. Our heating bill is essentially zero because we get over 99% of our space and water heating from the sun. And because we're so efficient, our household electric bill is about $5 a month. The extra cost of all that efficiency added 1% to the construction cost and paid back in the first 10 months. That kind of solar energy, passive solar space and water heating, is extremely cost effective if you do it right. And we're also just installing on the roof some solar cells, which ordinarily aren't cost effective unless you're at least a quarter mile from a power line, and then it's cheaper to get efficiency and photovoltaic cells for solar electricity than to run the wire to hook up to the grid. But in our case, they're worthwhile anyway because they give us much more reliable and higher quality power than we can get from the utility. And that saves us from having to buy some very fancy and costly power supplies for our computers.
Well, what might individuals living in Detroit or San Francisco or New York, in our large urban centers where they don't have access to this kind of land or these kinds of facilities, what might they do? Are you suggesting that common thing of, well, turn off the CD player, turn off your lights when you leave the house? Are those really alternatives?
We are specifically not talking here about doing without anything or being, as used to be said, hotter in the summer and colder in the winter. What we're talking about is doing the same jobs as well or better, using less electricity by using more brains, using better technologies. And anybody, no matter where they live, can wring a lot more work out of the electricity and other forms of energy they already have. For example, the next time you buy a refrigerator, by informing yourself what's on the market, you can get one two or three times as efficient as you have now, and it'll cost about the same and have the same features. It's just designed better with thicker insulation in the walls and so on. And if you don't have electric space or water heating, the refrigerator is probably the biggest single part of your household electric bill. It's probably upwards of $10 a month, so you can save half or two-thirds of that at essentially no extra cost. If you're going to buy a color television, you could get one with the same features, same price, using 40 or 50 watts instead of 150 watts. There are seven things you can do to your electric water heating system and the uses of water, like shower heads, that will give you as good service or better using a third as much electricity. And the list goes on and on like this. I think people are pretty smart and can solve a lot of their own problems if they have access to information about what the best buys are, where to get them, and how to shop for them.
Let's talk a little bit about automobiles, because that seems to be very intimate and well-known to most Americans. Fuel-efficient prototype cars have been developed and tested. For example, Volvo has tested a car that gets 71 miles per gallon. Peugeot has developed a car that gets 92 miles per gallon. Why aren't these cars on the American market?
Well, it's especially interesting to ask that because those two particular models are claimed to cost nothing extra to build. Why aren't they on the market? Well, very simple. The car companies, like the oil companies, foresee essentially flat real oil prices for at least 20 years to come. So there's really no incentive for them to take the risk of completely new tooling, new stocks of spare parts, retraining all their maintenance people and so on for new kinds of cars when they can continue to make a profit and hold market share with the models and tooling they've already paid for. Now, fortunately, Massachusetts and California, and I think increasingly some other states, probably Iowa, are taking a leadership position. They're starting to consider ways to affect people's car buying decisions up front. For example, by having a fee on new cars if they're inefficient. The more inefficient they are, the bigger the fee. And then using that money to pay rebates to people who buy efficient new cars. The more efficient, the bigger the rebate. In fact, you could tie the rebate to scrapping your old car to get it forever off the road if it's worse than a certain efficiency level, or you could base the rebate for efficient new cars on the difference in efficiency between the new car and the old automobile which you scrap. And that would turn over the car fleet a lot faster and get those old petrol pigs off the road. Now, the basic reason for this is twofold. First, only a fifth of the cost of driving is fuel. So even if we had a hefty increase in the gasoline tax, it wouldn't have that much influence on what kind of car people buy, especially because when you buy a more efficient car, you tend to pay about as much more to buy it as you pay less to run it. So you end up indifferent to its efficiency over at least a threefold range, say 20 to 60 odd miles a gallon. But secondly, it is that at least threefold range of efficiency that the customer is economically indifferent to that is putting almost a car's weight per car per year of carbon into the air, driving global warming, that is creating a lot of urban smog and a lot of acid rain, and is making us pay about $50 billion a year of naval bills in the Persian Gulf. If we just improve the car fleet by 3 miles a gallon, we've got rid of our Mideast oil imports right there. So because these are real social costs, which we're all paying for in various ways, society has a strong interest in giving you a better trade-in offer on your old inefficient car than your dealer will give you. And I'm very pleased that a number of leading states are starting to appreciate this. I think California may introduce such a scheme first to clean up the air in, say, the Los Angeles basin. Massachusetts may do it for balance of payments reasons. They have a proposal to take their 5% sales tax on new cars and swing it over a range of 0 to 10%, depending on how efficient the new car is. And I think if a few states do that, it will get the 9 or 10 manufacturers who have prototyped cars in the 67 to 138 mile a gallon range to get them onto the U.S. market and start competing for those who will first buy such things. I know I would if one were available.
Do you think the development of an extensive rail network within the United States would be a positive development?
I think it would. It's often difficult to do because the rights of way have been bought up by others and used for other purposes. And the only way you can make rail public transit work economically is to make it simple, like most of the European systems, rather than things like BART or the Washington, D.C. Metro, which are grossly over-engineered and far too costly. But the Tijuana Trolley from San Diego is a good example of how you can run in the black in a private enterprise self-sustaining way just by having clever, simple design. And when you look back at the pre-World War I maps, and you find that in those days you could go from Boston to St. Louis entirely on trolley cars, and the interurbans averaged 50 or 60 miles an hour, you realize we've lost something very important and need to think seriously about rebuilding it. I think we can also learn from innovations in countries like Brazil, where they're getting, in certain urban commuter bus lines, anywhere up to 40 times the density of passengers per corridor per hour that we get in our best systems. Very simple innovations like a boarding pod. It's a kind of a plastic tube closed at one end that sits on the curb. You go in through the open end and pay your fare as you enter, and every minute a bus pulls up, big doors open in both the side of the pod and the side of the bus. The floors are at the same level. The people go right onto the bus. The doors close. The thing moves on. It's an incredibly cheap, efficient system, and their unsubsidized cost is only 10 cents a ride. I think we have a lot to learn from countries like Brazil that are having to solve these transit problems with no money, and they're getting real smart about it.
One of the goals of the Rocky Mountain Institute is seeking ideas which transcend ideology. Do you view ideology as an obstacle?
It can be an obstacle. We see this, for example, very much in the water wars. EPA, for example, is in the process of vetoing the proposed Two Forks Dam, a billion-dollar water storage project near Denver, partly because folks like us had shown you could get more water than that at less than a fifth the cost by doing some simple water efficiency measures instead. And I don't mean having wimpy showers and brown lawns, quite the contrary. I mean, getting the same services as now with a lot less water by using well-engineered shower heads, lawn watering equipment, toilets, and so on. And water providers around the country are doing this. But in the water business, as in the electric or oil business, you often find that people who cast themselves as champions of free enterprise are in reality corporate socialists. They want to be subsidized, but they don't want to have to compete with efficiency. They just want to sell more of their product rather than providing the mixture of energy or water and efficiency that is the best buy for the customer. And it's quite alien to them to think that it's okay to sell, say, less electricity and bring in less revenue, when in fact that may lower their costs more than their revenues. They may make more money selling less of their product. Just as, you know, if you're in the shoe business, you know you can make money on margin instead of volume. So there's some basic psychological obstacles to overcome. And really the ideas we're talking about are very conservative. They're based on free markets, consumer sovereignty, local self-determination, individual choice, really good Jeffersonian values. And we're finding increasingly that political conservatives appreciate that we're talking their language, even though the result we come up with also appeals to political liberals. We may get there by a different method that we think works pretty well. Now, markets, of course, can't do everything. They're designed to be efficient, not sufficient. They never tell you how much is enough or when the national product is becoming too gross. And they're never meant to achieve values like justice or integrity or community. So if markets do something good for whales or wilderness or God or grandchildren, it's purely coincidental. That's why we have a political system, and I'm very critical of efforts to substitute $1, one vote for one person, one vote. That said, however, markets are awfully good at what they were meant to do, efficient allocation of resources over the short term. And I think creative use of market mechanisms can solve a lot of our resource problems and do a great deal to clean up the environment, not at an extra cost, but at a huge profit.
The United States has approximately 6% of the world's population, and it uses something like 40% of the total world's resources. How are you going to persuade Americans to make do with less, or is that not what you're advocating?
It's a very pejorative and I think misleading description of what we're advocating. We're suggesting using resources in a way that saves money to do the same jobs or to do them better. Our house has essentially no heating bill in a very cold climate, and it stays more comfortable with no furnace than our previous house did with three furnaces. That's fine. That means, in effect, we're living in a one-barrel-a-day oil well. We're getting $19 of energy savings every day, and that adds to our discretionary income. We can do good things with it. In fact, we can buy more kinds of efficiency with it or give it to people who are doing good work in the world. I don't think there's any difficulty persuading Americans who are very pragmatic, bottom-line-oriented people that if there's a better, cheaper way to do something, they ought to adopt it, because we're not talking about sacrifice at all. That's not even in the vocabulary, and that's why we talk about energy efficiency, not energy conservation, just to avoid that ambiguity. The interesting thing about this in the global development context you raise is that the average rich country today is about three times as energy efficient as is the average poor country. And yet, in the rich countries like our own, we know how to increase, say, energy efficiency by at least a further fourfold, very cost-effectively, at present prices with present technologies. Well, that implies, in turn, when you put those two facts together, that if poor countries did it right the first time, if they became as efficient as we ought to be in the rich countries, then they ought to be able to expand their economies roughly tenfold without increasing their energy use at all. And meanwhile, in the rich countries, we could maintain or improve our standard of living while using several fold less energy than now over the coming decades, and we'd all meet in the middle.
Well, I think in that very issue of talking about the rich countries and the poor countries, you're raising some very serious cultural, political, and ideological issues. For example, I've talked to many people from the Third World who have a certain resentment toward the developed world telling them not to do this, not to develop this, not to essentially follow the so-called paradigm of the West.
We had a couple of guests from the Costa Rican government here yesterday. At the moment, we're working with a Ghanaian engineer who's trying to design energy efficiency programs for Ghana. They find our information of considerable value because it lets them choose, as they have every right and duty to choose, what kind of society they want. But it enables them to avoid our mistakes. I mean, why should they make the same old dumb mistakes we've made when they have the chance to make interesting new mistakes? developing countries can't really afford to develop if they're inefficient, because they can't afford the luxury of mistakes that we made. China is a lovely example. They decided it was time everybody had refrigerators, so they built 100-odd refrigerator factories. The fraction of Beijing households owning a refrigerator went from 2% to 62% in 6 years. But unfortunately, through inattention, they chose a rather inefficient refrigerator design and thereby committed themselves to spend billions of dollars they don't have to build power plants to run those inefficient refrigerators. So, in effect, they've hobbled their development and created power shortages in the name of trying to make their people better off. Now, if the people to whom this was pointed out are still around after the recent upheavals, I don't think they'll make that mistake again. They now realize that the only way they can hope to develop is to do it right the first time. And if that means adopting the best, not the worst, of our technologies, that imposes, as I think it does, a duty on us to export our most efficient, not our least efficient, technologies and to set a good example. People in the third world are rightly very sensitive to hypocrisy, and I must say we find our message much easier to deliver from a super efficient building that's pleasant and saves a lot of money than if we were in an ordinary office with terribly inefficient lights, motors, and so on all over the place.
Well, and you're also not the World Bank or the International Monetary Fund or the U.S. government.
No, but we're trying to work with those kinds of organizations to show that they could get at least 10 times as much benefit for the people they serve if they promoted efficiency as if they just continue to build power plants to run inefficient equipment.
In your writings, you seem to favor a more bottom-up approach, a grassroots approach, rather than the traditional top-bottom. Am I correct in that?
Very much, yeah. We're Jeffersonians, not Hamiltonians. We do not adopt the, I think, pernicious notion that most people are pretty dumb and need expert elites and bureaucracies to tell them how to live. And this is a thing that worries me about the global warming debate. You see, we really need technology transferred to the policymakers in Washington who don't realize that you can now very cost-effectively save three-quarters of the electricity and oil we use. And therefore, if you go to global warming conferences of several days with experts from all over the world, you'll find that the conference agenda typically leaves 5 minutes to talk about energy efficiency. Because after all, according to the organizers' view of the world, everybody knows that energy efficiency, although nice and essential, is going to be slow, small, difficult, and costly. So why talk about it? And yet, if they really caught up with modern developments in new equipment, new technology, new ways to finance and deliver it to the customers, they find it pretty much solves their problem. Now, because it is cheaper to save fuel than to buy and burn fuel, you can actually abate things like CO2 and acid rain and urban smog at a huge profit, a profit ultimately of about $1 trillion a year worldwide, which equals the entire world's military budget. That's a lot of money. In this country, the energy we waste still amounts to more than our entire military budget of $10,000 a second. And we're not getting any benefit for it. All we're doing is turning fuel into pollution. Now, I think that implies two important things. First of all, we shouldn't be trying to come up with an international treaty, as we did for chlorofluorocarbons, in which nations agree to share a sacrifice and to do something expensive and inconvenient for the common good. Instead, because saving energy is going to save lots of money, we should be helping nations, firms, and individuals behave in their economic self-interest. Secondly, it implies that the implementation ought to be largely through creative use of market forces rather than through establishing new bureaucracies and mandatory regulations.
Stephen Schneider of the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado, has written much about the global warming effect and has talked about it as well. He has suggested that there must be a political will in the United States to address these problems, some of which you've touched upon in this interview. Do you see that political will? Do you see that political will, that consensus developing?
Yes, and I think, in fact, the people are way ahead of the politicians. You know, the old bumper sticker that said, if the people lead, eventually the leaders will follow. We have some leaders. We have, for example, the legislation proposed by Claudine Schneider, Republican Congresswoman of Rhode Island, and Tim Wirth, Democratic Senator from Colorado. And those have a lot of excellent ideas. But I think at a local and individual level, we're seeing even more leadership emerge. And that's, again, largely because even though people are rightly worried about global warming and other environmental problems, what everybody will agree on is saving money. And the things we need to do to, for example, abate global warming are things we ought to be doing regardless, even if we weren't worried about that at all, because we're going to make money on the deal. To abate global warming, we need to do three main things. One is energy efficiency. That has a strongly negative cost because efficiency is cheaper than fuel. Another is adopting sustainable farming and forestry practices. That's roughly a break even, as the National Academy of Sciences just concluded. Sustainable farming practices with low inputs, basically what you might call organic farming, is about as profitable as chemical unsustainable farming, often more so. And there are a lot of other reasons to do it, including not having poisons in our food and water. And thirdly, we need to displace the CFCs, the chlorofluorocarbons, but we need to do that anyway to protect the ozone layer, so the cost is irrelevant. Now, if the cost of abating global warming then ranges from strongly negative to roughly zero to irrelevant, why fiddle while coal burns? It doesn't matter how the scientific uncertainties come out. We ought to be getting on with the job regardless.
That was Amory Lovins on energy efficiency. Amory Lovins is co-founder of the Rocky Mountain Institute in Old Snowmass, Colorado.
And you are tuned to KBOO in Portland, 90.7 FM.
This news brief brought to you by the International News Net.
In Iraq over the weekend, 19 Iraqis were killed and 13 wounded. Four Kurdistan PKK rebels were also killed. Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki informed U.S. officials any U.S. military pullouts must be done with Iraq's approval. Al-Maliki said he did not want any withdrawals except in areas considered 100% secure. The Status of Forces Agreement between the two nations requires U.S. forces leave cities by June of this year. In Afghanistan, a roadside bomb killed four U.S. soldiers. In Kapisa province, a French soldier and five Afghan troops were also killed. More than 60 foreign soldiers have been killed in the country this year. In Britain, the worst economic slowdown since the Great Depression has wiped $50,000 from the wealth of every adult in the country, a national total of over $2 trillion. Research by accountants PricewaterhouseCoopers shows property and shares fell 28% between July 2007 and February 2009. The UK Independent says such colossal destruction will take many years to recover from and threatens the retirement plans of millions of Britons. The PwC research shows house prices have dropped 20% and equities 40%. Economists fear that the fall in value of houses, pension funds and shares will further depress the economy, damaging confidence, reducing spending and prompting more sell-offs in stock markets and by homeowners. Authorities are concerned that deflation that took hold in the Great Depression could happen again unless the vicious circle is broken.
For more news and exclusive interviews, see the complete International News Net World Report each weekday evening on Free Speech TV, 9415 Dish Network, or visit our website, inworldreport.net.
Stay tuned every evening at 5 for the KBOO News, produced by volunteer news teams right here in our Portland studios.